You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week David Gallup, who is president of the World Service Authority, a global public service human rights organization founded in 1954. Previously, he was a Dean's Fellow at the Washington College of Law's International Human Rights Law Clinic, where he researched asylum and international human rights issues, developed and maintained a human rights document library, coordinated a human rights education workshop, and represented asylum applicants. For 15 years, David Gallup was the secretary of the UN Association Task Forces on UN Restructuring and on Cultures of Peace. Gallup wrote several chapters in a UN Association report entitled Restructuring the UN to Meet 21st Century Global Needs. He's a legal columnist for World Citizen News. David Gallup, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Great to have you on here. Tell us a little bit about the World Service Authority.
Yes, World Service Authority was founded in 1954 by a man named Gary Davis, who we can talk about in just a little bit. The main focus of World Service Authority is to educate about, to promote, and to implement human rights, world citizenship, world law, and to for all of us to come together to create the institutions of law that we would need at the world level to help us all as one human family to live together peacefully.
Some people would suggest we have those in the UN. Others would suggest we don't want those at all. What's your vision?
Well, the UN was founded to rid the world of the scourge of war. That's what the preamble of the UN Charter mentions. But there have been a couple hundred wars since 1950, at least, all around the world. So, unfortunately, the UN has not been able to achieve the task it was created for, not to say that the different administrative agencies of the UN aren't doing good things, because they are. They're helping people on the ground in the here and now, but I would say more as a band-aid, you might say, to patch up the problems that are ongoing, and not really to get to the root causes of violence and oppression and human rights problems for people long-term. So the UN, although it's a nation-state system institution, and unfortunately, because of the UN Security Council and the veil of national sovereignty, it really becomes almost like a smokescreen for the nation-states to continue to wage war. So I would say that what we're trying to do at World Service Authority, how is it different, how are we offering something new and different, is that we're offering to create, with the help of the global public, institutions that come from us, the people, as world citizens. And so they will be global institutions, not ones that are beholden to any one nation or people, but to all of humanity and to the earth. And the UN can't do that at this point in the way it's structured.
So you would maybe not put the five biggest weapons dealers on the planet in charge with special veto powers and privileges over the other nations in an ideal model world system. There's a lot to talk about in terms of ways to reform the UN and ways to replace it. But you mentioned Gary Davis, who should be familiar to some listeners of this program and to people who have seen a film about him, World Beyond War, which I work for organizing. Events screening that film. Can you remind people a little bit about who Gary Davis was?
Sure. Well, Gary Davis was a young Broadway actor in the early 1940s. His brother went off to war and was on his battleship in Salerno in Italy, and his battleship was bombed, and his brother was killed, and that was really devastating to Gary. His big brother was his mentor, his person he was going to write comedy shows and comedy acts with and continue acting with. But once he was killed, Gary felt really anger and then vengeance, and he felt like he needed to join the Air Force and bomb Hitler's war factories. But once he was up in the airplane in his B-17 bomber, he looked down as the bombs were falling, and he knew that these bombs were falling on not just supposedly military, legitimate, quote-unquote, military targets, but they were killing women, men, children, civilians. And he was really repulsed. One of his missions, his plane was shot down. He was interned in an internment camp from which he escaped. But so when he came back from the war, he was very disillusioned with the entire nation-state system that forced him to kill his fellow humans, who he would rather have been making laugh than killing. So he said, I need to do something bold. I need to do something big. I need to get out of this system. He had post-traumatic stress from the war, and he had read a book called Anatomy of Peace by Emery Reeves, and he had begun looking into what a group at that point, which was called the World Federalist Association, was working on to try to create what you might call a world federal government, sort of like what we have here in the United States or what exists in Western Europe, but at the global level. And he said, okay, this is interesting, but he had also heard of a young man who had gone back to Europe, gone to Germany to help rebuild the churches that he had destroyed. And Gary felt, well, look, I did a lot more than just destroy some churches. I killed a lot of people. Instead of having vengeance anymore, he felt remorse, and he needed to make a change. So he flew off to Paris, tried to renounce his U.S. citizenship initially by handing in his U.S. passport and being given the oath of renunciation. But his father, who was a wealthy band leader, an orchestra leader, didn't want him to do it, and he was telexing the consulate saying, don't let him do it. He's just shell-shocked from the war. But finally, a few days later, when he came back to the consulate, the woman in the consular section said, well, what are you doing back here, Mr. Davis? He said, well, I'm here to renounce. And she's like, well, you sure? Have you thought about this? So in any case, finally he said, look, if you don't give me the oath of renunciation immediately, I'm going to call your superiors in Washington, D.C. and report dereliction of duty. So she scrambled, looking around in her desk for the oath of renunciation. He raised his right hand. He was given the oath. But, of course, the second he stepped out of the U.S. embassy in Paris, he was in France illegally because he had to give up all his documents. He became undocumented, like the almost 70 million people now who are either stateless, who are refugees, or either internally or externally around the world today because of oftentimes due to war and oppression, but even now, of course, due to environmental degradation. So he had to come up with one of his favorite people to quote was Albert Einstein, who says imagination is more important than intelligence. He said, I had to imagine a world where I, as an undocumented, I don't like to call him stateless, I like to call him world full, because he was full of love for the world. He had to come up with a way to govern himself and then how he could interact with the rest of the world, even though they wanted to see him as nothing, as persona non grata, because he had no documents. And that was what led him to several years later, after having been arrested about 20 different times just for having no documents, to create the World Passport, to create World Service Authority, and to create, a predecessor to this World Citizen Government was an institution where he helped to register almost a million people officially as world citizens. Now, but it wasn't that wasn't enough. And he said, look, we need not just a registry of world citizens, we need a government of, by, and for the people of the world. So with that, the basis of those almost a million people, and Gary once told me that, he said, David, it wasn't just about the million people who registered. There was almost 7 or 8 million other people who sent postcards of support to our offices in Paris during the years of 1949 through 1951 in support, even if they didn't themselves register. So there was a big outcry for something different, even something beyond the United Nations, because at that point a baby organization. People weren't sure what would become of it even a few years later. So he said, we need this world citizen government, and that's what he helped to found with other world citizens in 1953 and then World Service Authority in 1954 to raise awareness. And you might still say we're at the initial stages of this whole process, this whole movement. Gary himself might not have called what we're trying to do to promote world citizenship as a movement. He would probably simply say, like he did in that film, The World is My Country, I'm just one world citizen among a community of world citizens. But the reason he renounced was to say, well, no one else besides me really has to renounce. They just have to accept something higher, an allegiance to humanity and the earth. And it's at that level where we can work together as human beings first and foremost, not based upon some kind of arbitrary separation of people, usually that was created by wealthy white men who separated the planet into different places for their own economic, usually, benefit, but to come together as one human family. And I think it took a few events. We're still not there yet, but a few sort of revolutionary events, like the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, to see that humanity had the power just to destroy humanity and the Earth. That was one awakening moment, and I would say maybe another was in the the early 1950s or mid, when satellites were put out around the Earth, and with those satellites we could attach cameras and look back at the Earth and see the Earth really is one. And that it's not really separated. I mean, any astronaut who goes out into space knows when they look at the Earth, they look back and they say they know that it's one Earth. And
yeah.
The folly and ridiculousness of our separating ourselves is really what World Service Authority is trying to educate people about, and what this World Citizen Government is trying to act as a counterpoint to the neo-nationalism that we see as fervent nowadays. But I think that's really just only a temporary. Concern. I think people will be coming towards this understanding or appreciation of the one world that we have. We have to, if we're going to survive, whether it's beyond war or whether it's beyond environmental degradation, we have to come together.
Well, it's going to have to be both of those things or we won't survive. We're speaking with David Gallup, who is president of the World Service Authority. It seems that education, that getting people just to think differently about who they are, to think of themselves as citizens of the world rather than just of a country or some smaller jurisdiction, is a big part of this. How does one go about getting a world passport, and what happens to you when you do? How does it change your way of looking at things?
Well, the point of the world passport, at least initially for Gary Davis and for other stateless or undocumented people, was because if you had a document in your hand, what that meant is a border official couldn't just outright say no to you. They would have to, it became like a tool for someone to say, look, I do exist. Let me just tell you a quick story. I was taking a tour of the European court in Strasbourg in France several years ago, and it was just about five or six of us, and the tour guide asked where we were all from. And she got to me. I was the last person she asked, and I said, planet Earth. She kind of laughed, and she's like, well, no, but you have to be from somewhere. So I got out my World Citizen card, which is a separate document from our world passport that we issue, and I showed it to her. She's like, oh, my gosh, I guess you are from planet Earth. And what was funny to me, and then she said, well, where can I get one of those? And she said, after the tour, tell me. So, but then what was funny to me is that she put more credence in that paper, plasticized paper document that she did in me telling her that I was from planet Earth, which is kind of ridiculous. So you might say one of the reasons why Gary Davis created the World Passport was really to help us to move beyond the idea of papering or documenting ourselves, because even a piece of paper, you might say, separates us from our fellow humans. And so the point is to get to a situation where we don't need documents anymore to say, I am human, I have human rights, I have the right to travel freely on my own planet. I have the right to identify myself so that other human rights that I have will be met. Well, so that's really the principle behind the world passport. You could say that there is actual law that reaffirms it. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 13, affirms the right to freedom of travel. Article 12 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights affirms the right to freedom of travel. Both affirm the right to identification as individuals before the law. So there is a legal basis already for this world passport. Besides the legal precedent for the world passport, there was actually a passport created by a Norwegian explorer named Fridtjof Nansen between World War I and World War II. And his office, the Nansen Passport Office, documented many of the stateless people who had fled various countries after World War I, and his office won the Nobel Peace Prize for doing so. You could say that the World Passport is actually the successor document to the Fridtjof Nansen Passport. And many people who are stateless and undocumented, the millions of people around the world, are seeing this as a document that could help in that kind of situation.
It conceivably could be a way for those who do have and are keeping their national passports to form solidarity with people who are stateless and undocumented. I've got in my hand, I just took out of my wallet, a card with my photo that says, this is to certify that David Swanson is a member of the human race with all the rights, responsibilities, and privileges thereof. Where can people, a web address, or how do you go about, where can people get this kind of card and a world passport and world citizenship?
Well, it's a simple process. People can apply to the World Service Authority either by submitting an application form through the mail or even through email. We have a website, worldservice.org, where people can download the application forms, fill them out, and, as I said, send them in. Or if people will email us to info@worldservice.org, we can send a PDF application form in multiple languages, as well as an explanation of all the procedures for applying. But simply, people have to provide their personal data, like their names, their birth date, their birthplace, height, eye color, et cetera. We vet each applicant through our compliance program, and then once that's done, we issue the documents and send them to most anywhere in the world. So once again, it's a simple process to get either the world passport, to get the world citizen card and certificate. We also offer other documents that affirm other human rights that have been stated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, for example, our World Identification Card, which affirms Article 6 of the Declaration, which states that everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. We offer a World Media Association Press Card for people in the professional media. We offer a World Birth Certificate. Quick example of that, there was a child born of non-ethnically Russian parents in Russia, and the child was having trouble simply because the Russian government would not give him, because of discrimination, a birth certificate. He couldn't go to school. He couldn't go to the doctor and get his inoculations. But once we issued him the World Birth Certificate, the local authorities accepted that. He was able to go to school and able to see a doctor. So it's amazing how just by providing a documentation to someone who can't get one or who is rejected by a government because of discrimination, how receiving these documents can really change their lives.
That's wonderful. Makes those Russian authorities look pretty horrible and pretty great at the same time there. I wanted to mention also that World Beyond War very soon is going to be working with the World Service Authority to let people who become donors to World Beyond War get a world passport. And so we are very grateful to you for letting us set that up. I think it's a great thing. And also you're going to be speaking, David Gallup, you're going to be speaking at World Beyond War's annual conference coming up in September in Toronto, and speaking on the topic of world government. Or, well, tell us what you're planning for that workshop.
Well, so I'm trying to keep it a little bit secretive here, David, because I'm going to ask the basic question I'm going to start with is, what are the most important questions of the 21st century? But I don't tell you what those questions are yet, and I'm also hoping that participants in the event will come to the event with ideas themselves of what they think are the most important questions of the 21st century. I can tell you, of course, these will be questions about identity, questions about law, questions about governing our structures and how we behave. And what I love about how we're co-promoting World Beyond War and World Service Authority together, not only at the No War 2018 conference, but even also through the website and with the World Passport, is because what you are doing and what we're doing is so dear to my heart and so dear to your heart, so dear to the heart of Gary Davis, the founder of World Service Authority, which is to say, look, we can have a world beyond war. We just have to create it. We have to develop the institutions and a common world law that doesn't maybe fully exist yet, where there's a thought process in this area, but we can come together and create it. I mean, we want a world where if you kill someone on the streets of Washington, D.C., if you kill someone on the streets of Baghdad, you cannot get away with it just because you're wearing a military uniform. I mean, with that, this lack of common world law and the lack of law between nation states is the breeding ground for war. So, I mean, I'm always impressed to see, you know, what you've written, like when the world outlawed war, about the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which still has never, as you know, has never been overruled. The real war is illegal now.
Indeed.
But the war game continues. So this is so some of these issues will, of course, will come up in what I'm going to be talking about at the conference at the end of September.
Well, I'll make you a little wager. I'll make a prediction on what people are going to say. And you can ask the people in the workshop whether they heard this show and then,
okay,
you know, rule them out, but because they had time to prepare. But I predict people are going to, many are going to say the big question is, will we survive militarism and will we survive environmental destruction? And these, to my mind anyway, seem like some of the big reasons to have world government. I mean, what do you envision structurally? What are we aiming for in terms of a system of world law or world institutions that can actually address these kind of global problems?
Well, so I'm going to give you some general terms here, but then I'm going to back it up with a specific, which I think will help everyone listening to know what I mean. When you say world government, people are like, what could that be? What would that mean? They think it might be something tyrannical or dictatorial. Well, that's not at all. When we say the term world government, we mean a world citizen government, a government of, by, and for the people of the world, which would have appropriate checks and balances, which would mean, in my understanding, a world parliament, for example, or a world congress, where the people of the world get to decide what laws we are going to make to create that common world law, to outlaw, you say, and enforce the outlawing of war and killing or aggression. We need a world court of human rights, which doesn't yet exist, but I'm working on that process with an attorney up in Burlington, Vermont, who's helped us to draft a new statute for our world court, and we're going to hopefully also in Canada, perhaps in November, have an event where we'll be having a workshop about that World Court of Human Rights. Also, the idea of having a world peace or police force, sort of using the Gandhian Satyagraha movement of nonviolence to act as a go-between amongst people so that conflict will not erupt into violence, to give people tools and arbitration and other ways to handle their frustrations rather than lashing out at one another. So that's just obviously seems like almost utopian, you know, for us to be able to create those. But let me give you an example down to earth here that explains that we already have, in a sense, world government functioning, and you may not even know it. Have you heard of something called the Universal Postal Union?
I think I have, but I couldn't describe it to you.
Okay. The Universal Postal Union is the international organization which is affiliated with the United Nations that actually sets the rules through domestic and international mail manuals on how a piece of mail gets from one part of the planet to the other. There are rules. Now, if I asked you, do you know who the Secretary General is of the Universal Postal Union? I think you probably don't know who that is. Right?
I do not know.
Yeah, it's a guy named Bashar Hussein. And the only reason I know that is because every time I talk about this, I look it up and make sure it's still him. but I wouldn't really care who is the head of this Universal Postal Union as long as if I'm sending a letter or something through the mail to my Aunt Millie in Tokyo, Japan, for example. If she gets the letter, I've paid my little fee, you might say, which is the postage stamp, so she gets it. I've exercised my right to freedom of expression, and she receives it. Do I care who's running that Universal Postal Union as long as my fee that I've paid has been successful and my document or my letter gets there? No, I don't really care who's running it. So we see world government, whether it's through a world parliament or world congress or world peace or police force or even some kind of world executive council, like you might say Switzerland has, where there's seven heads of state, you might say, that run through each year the next person sort of takes over. We don't really care who is running our government as long as they're doing a good job and fulfilling what we want them to do. So I see that sort of the Universal Postal Union already as a world government of the post, you might say. It's functioning in the background. It's acting as a service, and that's why the Postal Service is called a service, because all government should be a service to you and me and to everyone. It should be helping us to fulfill what we can't do as individuals or even smaller communities. It can only hopefully help us with what we need to do on the world or global level. So as long as we can have some kind of governmental structures that help us serve us and help us to achieve what we want to achieve as the people of the world, and running in the background, that's all we want. I mean, we don't want it to tell us, you know, what everything that we want or should be able to do in our local communities, and this is why there should be a principle of subsidiarity, meaning that there should be more local and more global systems of governing, which we're not in that situation now, and that's what we're hoping through World Service Authority to raise the awareness that we can do this. But like I said, that with the Universal Postal Union, it's already functioning. We just need to bring it to the level of politics, not just the post office.
I do recall having heard that example somewhere when you bring it up, and it's a good one, and I'm with you. But let me just play devil's advocate for a few minutes we have left.
Sure.
There's probably not a ton of money to be made off creating disorganized, ineffective mail services. There's a great deal of money to be made from destroying the natural environment of the Earth and from promoting wars. So how do you achieve at a larger level than anyone has achieved it thus far, or even attempted it, a democracy of billions of people that can resist corruption when these little national governments have such a hard time resisting corruption?
Yes. Well, I would say that we have to look at the world situation we're in. And there was a book by, I think it was Wendell Willkie, who called One World or None. And unfortunately, I think we're at that stage. And you mentioned this already about the kind of questions that people might be bringing up at my What Are the Most Important Questions of the 21st Century workshop is survival of humanity and the Earth. And if the Earth dies, we die with it. So I think it's the job of World Beyond War and World Service Authority and other, not just peace action groups, but even environmental groups, for all of us to come together and speak as with one voice to say, if we are going to survive both the human destruction that we basically allow corporations and national governments to continue, or if we're going to avoid the environmental degradation that we also corporations and governments are waging, you might say, against the humanity and the Earth, then we have to devise these systems. It's basically we don't have a choice at this point. We have to choose. We have to choose one world, or we'll have none. And once again, if the Earth dies, we all die with it, and that doesn't make sense. So we have to allow corporations to understand, just like they've started to understand, that going green actually can make them more profitable. We need to know how making corporations, and I don't know what the color, is it blue? For making the corporations and governments going towards peace, how do they see that as profitable, but also profitable. We have to look at even the profit motive and the economy of the world, and question even those principles. Like, do we want forever to have growth and more growth and more growth? That's also destroying the planet. So we have to. There's so much, David. It was just a few minutes here. I cannot get into all the economic, social, and governmental concerns that all really are linked together, that we have to think about to save our world, to save humanity. And once again, if you look, there's a great, and I think you can still find it online. It's a document called What the World Wants and How to Pay for It. And it's a document which has a whole bunch of little boxes on it. And it covers a whole 8.5 by 11 sheet. But the bottom corner, the one quadrant of that, one fourth of that page is blocked off in little squares, or bigger squares, actually. And basically what that's saying is, if we move towards creating livingry instead of weaponry, like Buckminster Fuller would say, and if we spend even one-fourth of the amount of money that national governments and even corporations are spending on preparing for and waging war, we can use just even one-fourth of that money to prepare for and wage peace. Yeah. And when I say peace, I mean environmental peace, not just national peace or economic peace. It's a combination of all.
I couldn't agree more. Very well said. Wish we could continue. We will continue in person in Toronto at World Beyond War's conference, which everyone is welcome to sign up and attend or catch the live stream. David Gallup is the president of the World Service Authority. We'll have links up at talknationradio.org. David Gallup, thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, we think all of our interviews are special, but there are some that, for one reason or another, seem to strike a chord in listeners. Maybe because they engage questions that aren't often engaged or encourage alternative visions. In any event, we're happy for it, and we're going to revisit three of those conversations on this week's show. We'll hear from writer and organizer Josmar Trujillo about media hyping of gang violence and its destructive impact on community. Megan Hustings is director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. We spoke with her about the criminalization of feeding homeless people as part of a campaign of erasure. And finally, you might think you can't fix your cell phone because you don't have the know-how. It wouldn't occur to you that you don't have the right. We learned about that from Kyle Weens, an advocate of the right to repair. All of that's coming up this week on Counterspin. When local and federal law enforcement conducted an early morning raid in the Bronx in May 2016, arresting more than 100 people accused of gang membership, tabloids didn't waste any ink on words like alleged. But the New York Times wasn't less cartoonish. They told readers, quote, "For the last 10 years, life in the northern Bronx has largely been defined by wanton violence," close quote. And the Times was no less quick to cheer for this kind of militarized intervention, supposedly aimed at reducing violence. Counterspin asked writer and organizer Josmar Trujillo for some context.
Raids, and gang raids in particular, aren't new in New York City or really in the United States. But last Wednesday's raid, the size of it and the media hype around it, they're expanding from the last, I'd say, like 2 to 3 years, and probably even more so since the death of a police officer in my neighborhood in Spanish Harlem last October. A lot of that had to do with the strategy of the district attorney there, Cy Vance. Now, Cy Vance's father was the former Secretary of Defense under Jimmy Carter. Cy Vance has these really ambitious political aspirations, and so when he came in, I think he wanted to peg himself as like a gangbuster. If you look around in the city today, we have probably the slowest crime stats in city's history for like the last 50 years. There's no Lucchese crime family. You know, there's no big name mobsters or gangsters out there. So how can you become a gangbuster? You find gang members, or maybe in some cases create or hype up what are known as crews, which are these local groupings of young men in public housing that a lot of law enforcement equate to gangs. So Vance in 2014 launched this huge raid in West Harlem where 103 people were indicted, and that had set the city's record up until last Wednesday. Another part of that might have been the arrival of Bill Bratton. He not only has a lot of experience going after gangs in Los Angeles when he was the LAPD chief, but he's also really good at squeezing out as much mileage out of the media in terms of law enforcement. He's kind of renowned for being like a media master,
right,
as much as a police mind. So my best sense is the raids in East Chester Gardens last week, which, again, is, first of all, in the context of a city that is, like, much, much safer. But even that particular neighborhood, when you look at crime stat reports, again, the police department's own reports, has crime stats for, like, maybe the last 6, 7, 8 years. Every single year, more safe than the last. And in shootings and murders in particular, which is what the media was hyping up, the last crime stat report we saw was there was 2 shootings year-to-date so far in 2016. So again, not zero, but definitely much lower than highs of New York City at its peak had a couple of thousand murders a year. My best sense is that the raid itself last week, which included several federal agencies, it's one of the reasons is federal charges are being used against these suspects. So these guys are no longer being tried in state courts. They're being tried in federal courts.
But part of that is also just normalizing the role of federal authorities to deal with is basically street crimes, violent street crimes, but still street crimes. And my best sense is the federal agencies are trying to just find a place in crime because there's really not a lot of use for them in a lot of other areas.
Everybody wants a slice.
Everybody come on into the party while it's getting hot because the police department is making it a point. And in December, and with the help of the Daily News, they basically announced that they were going to be doing this and this is going to be the new normal. And part of that is using the media, like the Daily News, to create this idea that there's a gang on every street corner of New York City.
They also had that useful to the reader guide about your own relationship to gangs, right?
Yeah, I think the quote was, how close are they to you? And they had like this interactive map where you could basically, you know, very conveniently, you could, you know, plug in your street address and find out, oh, look, honey, there's a gang nearby.
I know listeners understand that we're not saying that none of the people arrested is guilty of anything. You know, that's a straw man argument we can dispense with. But the New York Times in their story had basically a single community source that wasn't an authority. And that was a woman who said, I'm so glad I would kiss the captain's feet, you know, talking about the raid. Well, you also talked to people in Eastchester Gardens in the wake of this most recent raid. What were some of the thoughts that people were telling you that didn't make it into that Times story?
So the very first person that we spoke to, and we went on there on Wednesday, you know, early evening, 10, 12 hours after the raid, and the first person that we spoke to, she was like, I don't know what they're talking about. I'm out here with Mike. She was out there with her two kids and her dog. She was like, I'm out here every night with my kids. I feel pretty safe. I've been living here since I was born. She was 37, so she's been there 37 years. I don't know what they're talking about. If there was any violence, it was probably like 10 years ago, and it's much safer now. She said, as you can see, I'm out here at night with my kids, and the media is playing this up as if this is a place that people were afraid to step out of their front door. So we went and talked to a few other people, and a couple of people didn't want to talk to because some people, you know, are maybe also apprehensive about talking to the media because they think that their words are going to be twisted. We really didn't find anyone who said, who had anything about kissing the captain's feet. I'm sure there's some people there who thought that this was a good idea, but most of the people we talked to, actually every single person we talked to, said the raid was over the top. Some of them differed on whether the violence was big or not big. Again, the shootings and the murders are above zero, so any number above zero, you could say, deserves attention. But one young woman that we spoke to, who she was with another young man, she was crying because she knew some of the people who were caught up in the raid. And she said these people didn't have anything to do with it, or if they were involved in anything, low-level drug dealing or anything like that, this was years ago. And many of them had served sentences and were already coming back, were starting to raise families. So to the extent that there was even people who were involved, a lot of them were changing their life around. And the raid kind of threw them on these federal racketeering charges that made it sound like they were, like, you know, John Gotti. And the heartbreaking part of it is a lot of these young people don't have lawyers that John Gotti could afford. They didn't even have the opportunity to speak to a lawyer before they were thrown in front of New York Post and Daily News front pages as gangbangers. This is something that I have to say as just being kind of like a city-based writer. Like, I've gone to places and I've seen reporters for local news cover, local news organizations talk to people who give completely different accounts of what the narrative is, and they won't run it. Like, I've seen it with my own eyes. There was a shooting a couple of years ago. I went over there, I tried to talk to people, and I saw people being interviewed saying things that were like, no, this is not what's happening, this is what's really happening. And local news coverage just won't run it. They'll wait and they'll look for someone that fits the narrative that they're already going in with, and they'll run that. And they'll run it prominently over and over and over and over. And that's why I think it's important to have alternative media be able to come in and say, like, this is what some other people are saying, to at least create some kind of conversation around it, because it's such a completely self-evident, if you were to read a Daily News article or a New York Post article or a New York Times article, for that matter.
There's a point at which the conversation about protecting a community becomes really demonizing the community. I mean, how are you helping anybody by declaring that their life is defined by wanton violence? We see neighborhoods turned into problems in themselves. It's not the crime, it's the community that becomes the problem. When you talk to community advocates, they have their own ideas about how to improve things in their community. If, say, the question is gang membership, you know, or violence in public housing, what are some of the things that those community members would point people to that we're maybe not hearing about?
there was a great article in a website called the Juvenile Justice Internet Exchange back in 2014 after the West Harlem raids. And it was actually being written before the raids happened. And the headline said it all. It said, "We asked the city for help, and we got a raid instead." And what people were saying and what that author and a lot of people had been saying for a long time is that to the extent that there was violence, community members wanted to steer youth away from violence to begin with, give them other options in a place where there's virtually no job opportunities, education is crumbling or non-existent. There is a sense amongst a lot of people of color in low-income communities across the city that this just condensation of poverty is at the root of any violence. And again, the violence is being hyped. But to the extent that there is violence, community members wanted an approach that really steered people away and got at root causes, and they were continually ignored over and over. And so what they got instead from the city was a giant raid, because that's what the city understands. That's what the police department understands. And politically, for their own reasons, it was self-serving. They want to show that they're, you know, tough on crime still, you know, even if the crime is a fraction of what it was 20 years ago. I mean, so they placed these kids on a basically like a super predator pedestal and frame them in this way. And all of those conversations about after-school programming, community centers that need to be reopened because they've been closed for 5 years. In Manhattanville, which is one of the houses in West Harlem, they had a community center closed for 5 years straight. All of those issues just are completely ignored. Poverty, we don't want to hear it. Opportunities, what's that? Like, it's about the gang raid, it's about the gang member this, gang member that, and that's all it ends up being for the people who hear about this in the media, and that's all they'll ever see about it. That's the double slap in the face. On the one side, you get the raid, and on the other side, you get the media painting your entire life as just revolving around violence.
We've been speaking with Josmar Trujillo. You can find his recent piece, NYPD Raids Won't Solve NYCHA's Violence Problem, on the No Backspace blog at citylimits.org, and Gang Raids and Our Addiction to Super Predators on Huffington Post. Josmar Trujillo, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine.
In the winter of 2017, seven people were arrested in Florida for the crime of serving food to homeless people in a public park. Media didn't take much notice, though one Wire report explained that while you might think feeding the hungry sounds good, it's, quote, actually a legally complicated matter that could violate laws and even send you to jail, close quote. Counterspin asked Megan Hustings, director of the National Coalition for the Homeless, for some background on food sharing and what municipalities that criminalize it are hoping you'll misunderstand.
What's key about food sharing, especially as Food Not Bombs tends to do it, which is going out into the community, into parks where people congregate, is that it finds people where they are. We have someone a longtime advocate who is homeless himself, who always says that homeless people are the least lazy out there because they have to walk, you know, 2 miles from the shelter to get their lunch and then 2 miles back to get dinner and come back at night. So oftentimes, even though there might be free food or meals available, they're not always convenient for folks who are staying outside. So those who do feed in public areas like parks are providing a very needed service.
Well, let's talk about the pushback on that, because what one gets from the media coverage, which of course is kind of thin and occasional, is, oh, sure, it sounds like a good idea, but there's really these actually very good reasons that it's not a good idea. What forms do the restrictions tend to take?
They can take many forms. The restrictions that we know about have been anywhere from requiring a permit, which I believe is what is on the books in Tampa, a permit to share food, and sometimes that requires that you do it actually indoors or have some sort of facility where food prep is highly regulated. Orlando had a law on the books that said that you could not share food with more than 25 people in public places, so that folks were getting arrested when they handed out that 26th sandwich. In general, these ordinances have been around for a very long time. We've been tracking them for about 20 years, and what we see is that in general, what communities are in effect doing is making homelessness less visible. even though that might not be the outward intention, that's usually what happens. And in the case of Tampa, we have to mention that there was a large college football event earlier this week. And so it was odd that even though there had been a law on the books for a very long time that police and the city had not responded by asking the Food Not Bombs folks to move along until there was the event that a lot of people would be paying attention to in the city and perhaps wanted not to see this kind of sharing of food or these, you know, quote-unquote types of people in their city.
There seems to be this idea that somehow helping homeless people in this sense and feeding them is creating or driving homelessness, as though mm-hmm. if you didn't feed them, they wouldn't exist?
Yeah, and we find that very troubling, you know, especially troubling because homelessness has so many causes. And, you know, something that we have really highlighted in recent years with the increased number of encampments that are springing up across the country is there, first of all, there's not enough affordable housing in our communities, but also there's just not enough shelter either. And unfortunately, even federal funding has been, in recent years, kind of tailored more towards permanent supportive housing programs, which are extremely successful and really doing a great job of housing a small number of folks. And so there's a lot more people who are just not finding the resources or the help that they need on a daily basis. But again, I think what we see is not just restrictions on feeding, but also there's been lots of laws that restrict camping or sleeping, even sitting down in public places, sitting on sidewalks or even benches. There's not just ordinances, but also subtle things that cities do, like putting armrests in the middle of public benches so that you can't lay down. Here in D.C., we have bus stop benches that have little dividers between the seats, and they're very, very skinny so that it would be very difficult to lay down and be comfortable. So there's these little things here that are subtly saying we don't want to see people who are homeless in our cities, in our downtown areas. You know, we're trying to try to move them along in any way we can. And we just think that this is really antithetical to ending homelessness and truly doing something to help people get off the streets. And we understand that there's a lot of cities, mayors, who get a lot of feedback from their community that homelessness is a large problem, but we're not going to solve it by saying you can't be homeless here. You know, that's not looking at all at the causes of why somebody is homeless or really what the issues are that are preventing them from getting and affording long-term housing.
Well, let me just ask you finally, I guess mm-hmm. folks who are motivated to do things, we're all going to have to decide what our relationship to the law should be when mm-hmm. we disagree with those laws. That's going to be a choice that I guess more and more folks are going to be making. Let me ask you, are there not things that municipalities themselves can do? You know, we hear about places making themselves sanctuary cities, you know, so maybe mm-hmm. there's going to be a federal law that's pressing deportation, but we're going to make a statement that in our community we're going to do things differently. Are there those sorts of tools available in terms of homelessness and feeding hungry people?
Most definitely. You know, at the root of homelessness is the lack of affordable housing. Communities across the country, we're all struggling to find housing that we can afford. So that's kind of at the basic level. We really need more advocacy from folks, calling your legislators. They really do actually want to hear from you. And being involved in advocacy efforts to really increase funding for affordable housing programs. There's also a number of cities who have endeavored to support encampments and folks who live in them while longer-term housing solutions are found. So there are some encampments across the country who, and some cities who have agreed to, you know, do things like trash pickup and mail delivery services even, you know, anything to provide the higher standard of living for folks who only have the ability to live outdoors or there's not a viable option for them to be indoors at the moment. So that's definitely something that we encourage. If there's more of a realization that there are positive things we can do to ultimately end homelessness while also supporting those individuals who are on the streets right now, that's much preferable to the alternative.
We've been speaking with Megan Hustings, director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Find their work online at nationalhomeless.org. Thank you very much, Megan Hustings, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Copyright and farmers don't often appear in the same story. They did last spring when agricultural machine maker John Deere argued that farmers should not be able to independently access the operating software in their tractors, for example, because they don't own that part. They just license it. Or as our guest put it, Old MacDonald has a tractor, but he owns a massive barn ornament because the manufacturer holds the rights to the programming that makes it run. Kyle Weens is co-founder and CEO of iFixit, the online repair community and parts retailer. We asked him to explain the right to repair and the argument that John Deere and others are trying to make.
What's happening is that they want to control everything that happens with the life cycle of the product. With farm equipment in particular, the data that the equipment collects is actually worth a lot of money to John Deere. They're using every means possible to lock down what happens. They want to make sure that if you need to get repaired, you go to the John Deere dealership rather than doing a repair yourself. The way that they're doing that is they're saying, hey, it might be a tractor, but it has a computer in it, and we own the software on the computer, and you have an implied license to operate the software on the tractor, but you don't actually own the software that's on the tractor. And that's the part that I really disagree with them on. I think that if you bought a tractor, it's yours, and you should be able to do what you want with it.
And they're claiming it's a violation of copyright somehow, or at least that was their initial argument. Now they maybe have tweaked that with this licensing agreement with Tiny Print. But a lot of these companies are saying that this is an issue of copyright.
There's a few different ways that they go at it. One is back in 1998, when we updated the Copyright Act and passed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or the DMCA, they put a clause in it that said that it was illegal to circumvent a technological lock. And that was originally designed to prevent people from pirating DVDs. So they put locks or encryption on the DVDs to make it hard for people to copy them. And they said, we want to make it illegal to break that lock. And what's happened since then is the kind of locks that they put on DVDs now are in tractors and in our cell phones and all kinds of other products that we have.
And they have made the argument, haven't they, that somehow locking people out, well, it prevents harms if they try to repair something and they get injured. But then there's also a line that somehow it spurs innovation in technology. Does that make any sense?
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. And that's just kind of a bogus claim that they'll make. It really just comes down to monopoly control of the aftermarket. They want to make as much money as they can on service, and they want to make sure that the data is streaming back to them. If you talk to farmers, that's really the nutshell. With the older equipment, farmers are absolutely able to maintain it themselves. It's really only the newer equipment. And these are fairly sophisticated machines. I'm talking tractors with touchscreens. At one point, one of the arguments that John Deere said was that they didn't want people to be able to modify the software in their tractors because they might then use the tractors to pirate Taylor Swift music. And that sounds crazy, but it actually technically might be possible. Like, there's a full-blown computer on the tractor, so you might be able to install BitTorrent or something and do that. But clearly that's not the real reason they're trying to lock down the equipment.
That sounds like a real bank shot. Well, it sounds like Monsanto patenting seeds and then telling farmers they can't save them year to year, you know, because the technology of the seed belongs to Monsanto. It's the sort of thing that you think, well, this is too craven to actually be happening, you know, and yet here it is. And in your work, you make a number of interesting points, one of which is, what about when the company then just decides they don't want to repair that device anymore, or they don't want to make the parts for that anymore?
They can absolutely just decide repair isn't an option anymore. And that's something that we've seen folks like Apple and Samsung do. It's very hard to get the screen on a Samsung phone fixed because Samsung just won't sell repair parts. We see this over and over again where manufacturers will lock down the aftermarket. There's a problem with the iPhone 7 right now. If you break the home button on the iPhone 7, there is no way to fix it because repairing it requires a special calibration machine that only Apple has. And they refuse to sell it to aftermarket repair shops.
It really, as you say, it really is criminalizing repair, which seems like such a strange kind of value to be pushing. But I just would underscore for folks who think, oh, well, yes, it's an irritation. You need to buy a new phone every few years, and they're kind of forcing you into that. But you point out that, well, for one thing, there's an environmental impact to that. You know, it's really a societal level question that we should be thinking about.
Yes, yeah, so there's a huge amount of raw material that goes into these things. It's really an environmental imperative to figure out how we can make things last as long as possible. You know, repair jobs are green jobs. And any time you can fix a cell phone or keep some device that you have working longer, it prevents having to manufacture a new one. So that's a fantastic thing. And fortunately, I mean, this sounds all doom and gloom. These manufacturers are doing all these evil things and everyone's going to start doing it soon. There actually is hope on the horizon. This year, 11 states have introduced right to repair legislation that would require manufacturers to help the farmers and local cell phone repair shops and others stay in business.
It's not insignificant that automakers are prominent here. How do you think that this story relates to, for example, what happened with Volkswagen?
Yes, it's interesting. So before the Volkswagen case came out, I was actually arguing for an exception to the copyright law to be able to do repairs on vehicles. And the Association for the Global Automakers, which included Volkswagen, was at the table across from me negotiating. And they said that the automakers were the only ones that should be trusted to manipulate emission settings on vehicles and that no one else should have access to the software. And then 3 months later, we found out that they'd been manipulating the emissions readings. It's the same thing with TVs. Samsung and LG were caught cheating on energy efficiency ratings in TVs the exact same way that Volkswagen was. When it read that the test code was being played, they had different energy output than the rest of the time. So we have to find a way that the rest of us can inspect and verify. It's okay for manufacturers to make these products. They can certify them, but there needs to be a mechanism for third-party auditors to come in and inspect the source code and for the rest of us to be able to fix it if it breaks.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
I'm coming to a difficult realization. We suffer through early signs of climate shift, things like super hurricanes, storm surges, fires, and very strange weather. But the first and biggest hits of global warming are hidden from us, at the poles and in the ocean. Earth could experience catastrophic loss from climate change before humans realize it. You are about to hear breaking science pointing to hidden warning signs of extreme climate change. While we fret and sometimes die from heat waves on land, unreported marine heat waves are striking more often and more violently in the seas. Scientist Eric Oliver explains. Then Mark Eakins, the coordinator of NOAA's Coral Reef Watch, reports the latest science. Up to half the Great Barrier Reef of Australia has died in the longest marine heat wave ever seen. Most of the extra heat we generate with greenhouse gas emissions goes into the ocean. Hidden beneath the waves, that is where the climate action is. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio Eco Shock. For years, we have been told that most of the extra heat from our greenhouse gases goes into the sea. But what is happening there? I've written to experts around the world trying to get the big picture of marine warming. Crickets. Well, finally, we have a new paper published in the journal Nature, and it warns us about marine heat waves. The lead author is Eric J. Oliver. He earned his PhD in physical oceanography from Dalhousie University in Canada's Maritime Province of Nova Scotia. Eric has also been a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Tasmania. Many of his co-authors are Australian, with more authors from the UK, particularly Scotland and the United States. From Halifax, Canada, Eric Oliver, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, as you know, on land, a heat wave is pretty relative. People in the UK think they're cooking at 28 C or 82 Fahrenheit. That's just another day in Pakistan. So how do you define a marine heat wave?
Well, you make a really good point that what is or isn't a heat wave, what isn't extreme, is relative to what's normal in a particular region. So that is exactly what has informed the basis of our definition of marine heat wave. So we have a qualitative way of defining what is a marine heat wave. That is to say, it's a prolonged period of time where water temperatures are anomalously warm relative to what is expected at that time of year. And then we can further quantify that, which is what we did in this study, to say that a marine heat wave is triggered when water temperatures are higher than the 90th percentile for a particular time of year, and that persists for at least 5 days. And what the 90th percentile means is that it's a temperature that you would expect 9 days out of 10 to be less than. So 1 day out of 10 is that hot or hotter. And so if that temperature is exceeded for 5 whole days in a row, at least, then we've entered a marine heat wave state. And because that percentile calculation is dependent on the actual variability of temperature, that scales by region. So in somewhere like the tropics, where there's not a lot of variability of temperature, the percentile allows us to trigger a heat wave when it's only maybe 1 or 2 degrees warmer than typical summer temperatures, because that is quite extreme in the tropics. Whereas here, say off the east coast of Canada, the water temperatures are really variable. That might not be triggered until it's 3, 4, 5 degrees warmer than average.
And what got you looking into this, and why has this information been so hard to find?
In 2011, there was a marine heat wave that occurred off the west coast of Australia. And while these kind of extreme temperature events in the ocean have happened before, and certainly to a large degree are evident in the natural world, this one gained a lot of attention because it was so extreme. It was the coastal temperature loggers measured 5 degrees warmer than average in the middle of summer, and offshore measurements recorded by satellites said 6 to 7 degrees warmer than typical summer temperatures. And this event persisted for an entire month. So it was oceanographically and climatically really interesting and anomalous, but also there were impacts on ecosystems. So there were fish that were found out of range, there were fishery closures because of temperature sensitivity and things like abalone, and there were, the most interesting to me is the kelp forest ecosystem collapsed under the temperature stress, and there was a rise in the seagrass ecosystems in its place. And in fact, that change from kelp to seagrass has persisted since the event in 2011. So this event that came along caused an impact, and then the event went away, but the impact remained. That kind of ability of a transient event to permanently affect the system really shocked people, and it was quite interesting, let's say, from a scientific perspective. So a researcher based at the University of Western Australia, Professor Thomas Warnberg, brought together a few people to lead this working group on marine heat waves. So himself, Dan Smale, who's based in the UK, Marine Biological Association, myself and Professor Neil Holbrook. Neil is still, and I was at the University of Tasmania at the time, the four of us led this workshop that was held in Perth, Western Australia, in 2015. And we brought together a total of 15 researchers from around the world, from all those countries you mentioned at the beginning. And we cut across three main fields of expertise. We had climate scientists with a lot of experience in extremes. We had physical oceanographers, and we had the marine ecologists. And we got together for 3 days, and it's often hard to speak the same language when you've got a physical person and a biological person trying to talk about the same thing. We often, even the same words can mean different things. But if you're in the same room trying to have this conversation over a few days, you get there. And that's what we were able to do. And the outcome of this workshop was that we ended up with three lines of research that we would then scatter back around the world and pursue. And one of them was actually, how do you define a heat wave, which is how we came up with that definition that was published in 2016. And one of the other lines of research was, what can we say about the global record of marine heat waves? What's the global distribution like, and are there any long-term trends happening? The expectation being that there might be, given the kind of long-term warming we've been seeing in the ocean and the atmosphere for the last, well, decades to centuries.
Well, before we get into the specifics of the paper, I have to say, like, if fish run short due to marine heat waves, that can start minor battles between countries. It can threaten protein sources for millions of people. So this is a very important topic, and I'm surprised there haven't been more studies on this before.
Well, that's a really good point. And I think, I mean, there are a couple points to make about that. One is that there have been studies on marine heat waves. If you look up marine heat wave on Google Scholar, say, if you just type in the keywords, there's been essentially an exponential increase in that term being used. In the past, certainly people would have talked about sea surface temperature extremes or temperature anomalies, things like that. Certainly El Nino, that happens in the tropical eastern Pacific, you could characterize that as a marine heat wave. It's a period of time, quite prolonged, where water temperatures are very high. In 2003, there was an event in the Mediterranean, and that was published. They didn't use the term marine heat wave, but it fits very much into our framework. So people have been looking at these. But I would say that the difference between what happens in the ocean and what happens on land or in the atmosphere over land is that it's so much harder to see what goes on in the ocean. So when we have a heat wave on land, the most obvious impact is that humans feel stressed. We get hot. We don't want to do very much. We're sweaty. But we also see that, well, our animals get stressed out. In Australia, for example, they have flying foxes, which is like a large kind of bat, that once air temperatures reach 42 degrees, they just fall out of the trees that they hang on while they sleep. So the impacts are much more obvious in the atmosphere, whereas in the ocean, if you're a fisherman or if you're an ecologist who's out there interacting with the ocean regularly, then you can see that things are changing, although maybe you don't actually know that the water temperatures change unless you're measuring it. And the rest of us just kind of notice, oh, the beach is warmer today. So I would say that these events in the ocean are more hidden. So it's easier for them to go by unnoticed.
It recently hit the news that a swordfish was seen off the coast of British Columbia, and we also have seen more of the big tropical sunfish. So some surprising things are happening out there. We also had the blob, that this big pool of hot water that hung off the North Pacific, off the coast of Washington State and British Columbia for quite some time. Is that part of what you're studying?
Exactly. That is another example of a marine heat wave. That is a pretty interesting one because it was so persistent. A lot of these events that blink on and off around the world tend to be on the scale of maybe a few weeks to a few months, whereas that event persisted for something like two or more than 2 years. But it does nonetheless fit into our framework of what we think of as a marine heat wave, a prolonged period of anomalously high ocean temperatures. And it had the same kind of impacts. There were range extensions of different kinds of fish. There were fishery closures, marine mammal strandings, I believe, toxic algal bloom outbreaks. That one was interesting, though, because it actually fed back on the atmosphere, right, and affected weather patterns over Western North America.
It did, and I lived through it. Now, in your study, you talk about comparing periods starting around 1925 and moving up towards the present. How can we possibly know what the sea surface temperatures were in the 1920s or 30s?
Well, ships have been out measuring them, basically. But the longer answer to that question is that getting the right data sources and pulling the data together in the right way was a big part of that study, and I'd say one of the big successes of the study. So to define a marine heat wave, we really need daily measurements, fairly high-frequency measurements of temperature. And we were interested in doing this globally, so we needed this information globally. And that kind of information really has only been available since the early 1980s, since satellites have been recording surface ocean temperatures daily. However, we were able to supplement that data with two other sources of data. So one would be daily measurements, not global, but at a few sites around the world where they have recorded temperatures for a very long time, 100 years and more in some cases. Places like the lighthouses in BC, for example. There's a few stations along the west coast of the U.S. and some in Europe. These are just examples where over 100 years ago, someone decided we need to start recording temperatures, and they would go out to the shore with a bucket, literally, and measure it, or measure it off the end of the pier. And that has persisted until now. So we have these truly invaluable records of ocean temperatures, in situ coastal ocean temperatures. But that's not global. A third data set that we have that is global are analyses and amalgamations of data that would be recorded from ships that have been going around the oceans for hundreds of years, really. Ships have always been recording ocean temperatures. And these are more infrequent, and there are products that take these data and grid them and provide them in regular packages. And that can effectively give us global monthly measurements of temperature. So we have these three data sources: satellites, a few stations, and these ship-based records that can each have their own strength, whether it's daily, global, or long-term. And we're able to effectively borrow the strengths of each data set together to construct this record of marine heat waves going back to 1900.
So in the period from 1925 to 2016, did the frequency of heat waves increase?
It did. So our results show that there was a statistically significant increase in the frequency of marine heat waves. And we define frequency to mean the number of events that happen on average per year as a global average. So it's very average, but we're taking a global picture. And the data is showing us that in the early part of the 20th century, there were a little over two events that would happen per year. Whereas in the latter part of the record, so basically the last 30 years or so, that's increased to, in very recent years, up to four events per year, but on average, something like three events per year. I think that's a 34% increase, if I remember the number from the paper correctly.
And what about the duration? What did you find there? How long they last?
Similarly, so we defined this average duration, which is to say, you have so many events occurring per year, how long are they on average? Some events can be quite a bit longer, some are shorter, but on average in the early 20th century, they were about 10 days long. Whereas in the last 30 years, they've lengthened out to up to 14 days long.
So we're getting more of them and they're lasting longer. This sounds serious.
Correct, yeah. And while thinking about frequency and duration, it can be a bit confusing maybe to to think about that in a simple way. So an easier way is actually just to think of, well, how many days per year are part of a marine heat wave, or how many marine heat wave days are there per year? How many days are ecosystems going to be exposed to extreme temperatures? So if you have a certain number of events per year and they have a certain duration, then you have a certain number of days that are part of those heat waves. And that number has increased by 50% over the time period that we examined. So it's something like 30-ish days on average per year in the early 20th century, and that's increased up to around 40-45.
Now, we have natural cycles that you do talk about in the paper, like La Nina and El Nino and those sort of things. I'd like to leave those aside for a minute and zero in on what is the background sea surface warming trend, which, according to the paper, is 0.16 degrees C per decade. If that's true, one would think that over the past 100 years, the sea surface would have warmed by about 1.6 degrees C. And that is actually greater than what is reported for land warming.
Well, we do know actually that the ocean is a huge reservoir for a lot of the warming that's happening around the globe. So it, in a way, it's unfortunate that the impacts are so hidden and our attentions are diverted away from the ocean, because a lot of change that's happening in recent decades is happening in the ocean.
And it must take a massive amount of energy to increase the sea surface temperature at all.
I imagine it would do, yes.
And it's going to release that slowly, that heat. The whole ocean is going to release that heat again very slowly over centuries or longer. I've also encountered, along talking with various scientists, that there will become a point where the ocean ceases to become such an effective heat sink for our greenhouse gases. It should slow down their absorption rate, and then we get whatever we put into the atmosphere will come back on us much quicker, but I guess that's outside the boundaries of this study, is it?
Yeah, that's a longer timescale thing, but it's something that we need to be cognizant of when we're thinking about this. Because so what's going on there is that when we think about the oceans warming, we're often thinking about, well, it's the surface ocean that's warming. And there are certain areas around the globe where that surface water is convected down to the deeper parts of the ocean. So the North Atlantic is one area, or all around the Southern Ocean is another area. And this process is a fundamental part of the global climate system. You can think of it crudely as a conveyor belt. Maybe you've heard the global conveyor belt terminology in the past. So this is, for example, in the Atlantic, you have warm water brought north near the surface. In the higher latitudes, it cools and is made more dense and drops to the deep. And the time scale for which that water stays in the deep before it comes back up to the ocean surface is something like 1,000 or 1,000s of years. So now we're at the beginning of that process where the earlier tracks of that global conveyor belt, let's say, have this warmer water that's newly warmed because we've been warming the climate system over the last one and a half centuries. But as we continue to warm it and as it continues to pull it down, it's going to fill up that conveyor belt with the warm water. And once it's filled up, then it won't have that capacity to store it away anymore effectively.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With me is Canadian ocean scientist Dr. Eric Oliver. We are discussing his new paper, Longer and More Frequent Marine Heat Waves Over the Past Century. Eric, let's talk about what is happening in different parts of the world. Why don't we start with the region where you live, the Maritime Provinces of Canada, and of course, New England. What does your study show there?
Well, we didn't focus very much on the regional impacts, actually, in our study. We were trying to elucidate what's the global average trend, really, to make more bulk statements. But you can look at what the changes are regionally. And certainly on the long time scale of 100, 115 years, effectively, almost the entire ocean is experiencing these positive trends in the marine heat wave properties that we looked at. There's really only a few places where we don't see increases in the marine heat wave properties, and that really maps onto regions where we don't see strong increases in ocean temperatures. The biggest, the most conspicuous region being the far North Atlantic, and this has been noted before. There's what they've called a global warming hole in the high latitudes in the North Atlantic, where it actually appears to be cooling, or not warming at all, certainly on a 100-year timescale or so. And the consensus, as I understand it, that's emerging now is that this is being related to a slowdown in the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, which is one of the limbs of this conveyor belt I was talking about. It's that part of the North Atlantic that brings warm water or brings surface water down to the deep.
I didn't see any discussion in the paper of the actual Arctic Ocean. Is that why?
No, and that's because we excluded regions that had ice cover for longer than 5 days, which is most areas that have any kind of regular occurrence of ice. And that was mainly for statistical reasons, because we didn't want, because of the definition of a heat wave having to last for at least 5 days, it would have interfered with our ability to calculate heat waves. But that being said, it's obviously very important to look in those regions, in the Arctic and around the Southern Ocean as well. And now that I'm based back here in Canada and interested in these higher latitudes, I think it's something that I will be looking into pretty soon.
Yeah, we just had news of an ocean heat wave in the Tasman Sea between Australia and New Zealand, and I know you were working in Australia. What are marine scientists saying there, and how much is this part of the great threat to the Great Barrier Reef?
So what happens in the Tasman Sea and around southeastern Australia, I would say, is decoupled from what happens in the Great Barrier Reef in the sense of the specific drivers of those events, not talking about global climate change. What happens around Tasmania is really, really interesting, because Tasmania is a cool water ecosystem generally. So we have a lot of cool water species that have refuge there because much of the waters around Australia are much warmer. But unlike, say, here in North America, where if waters tend to warm, the cold water species might just migrate further north, in Tasmania, in Australia, you don't have any higher latitudes, actually. Tasmania is as cold as you get, and then you've got 3,000 kilometers of Southern Ocean before you find Antarctica. So when things happen there, when the waters are warming there, it can have really detrimental impacts. And they're losing things like their giant kelp forests, and a lot of their fisheries and aquaculture systems are under stress.
And when it comes to the long-term viability of at-risk ecosystems like coral or the food fisheries, or as you mentioned, why do you think heat waves matter even more than the gradual increase of mean sea surface temperature?
Well, I'd say they both matter. The key is that when an impact happens, generally, that's not because the mean has warmed. That's because an extreme has occurred, an extreme event has occurred, that extreme event sitting on top of the mean, which may have warmed, but the extreme event has occurred that's pushed something over some kind of a threshold. So really, it's the extremes that we feel. In the summertime, maybe, let's just say for the sake of argument, that this summer is 1 degree warmer than a typical summer 30 or 40 years ago, you're not really going to feel the difference between 25 and 24, say. But that extra degree can push the frequency of the more extreme events, those heat waves that are up in the 30s, that extra 1 degree can push the frequency of those extremes up in a way that you do feel them. And that's the same thing for marine heat waves. So the mean is important, but we feel the extremes, I guess, is the way to phrase that.
And just the idea of marine heat waves stimulates so many new fields of research. I think we could look, for example, at the effect on algae blooms. I've talked to experts on plankton, and they say, well, we don't really know how this is going to go, whether it will increase or decrease with global warming. And then we have the whole idea of marine heat interacting with storms. We know a hotter ocean can drive bigger hurricanes. There's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I think this is exactly the list that you put there, and I could add more. It opens up a very broad range of topics to study. And the thing I find exciting about it is that it opens up these topics that have cross-disciplinary aspects. So you listed a few that would mean physical and climate scientists working alongside ecologists or fishery scientists or working alongside hurricane researchers and forecasters and things like that. And that's one of the things I find it very exciting about it, that it has this sort of cross-disciplinary impact.
I realize science really reports on the past, but what are your thoughts, Eric, about the future of marine heat waves as global warming continues?
That's a really good question. So in our study, we showed that the rising marine heat wave metrics were primarily driven by the rising mean ocean temperatures. So effectively, the global warming of the oceans is what is driving this increased frequency and duration of the marine heat waves. And while we didn't demonstrate in our study, we can rely on other published works that have effectively shown that global warming of the oceans is an anthropogenic signal. And so therefore, the rising trends that we see are predominantly driven by anthropogenic or human-caused climate change. And so the next step then is to exactly what you say. How is this going to continue into the future? How do we expect these trends to go throughout the rest of the 21st century? And that's actually what we're working on now. And to do that, we need to turn to models. We actually, obviously, we don't know what it's going to be like in 20, 30, 40 years, but we have fairly sophisticated and very good computer models for the climate system, for the oceans. And so we can use these models to simulate a projected future state of the ocean under different kinds of emission scenarios to tell us what we might expect the future state of the oceans to look like and the future state of marine heat waves. I will say that regardless of what those results show specifically, and that's work in progress, so I can't give you any numbers, it is the case that regardless of how we change our emissions, I'm talking about greenhouse gas emissions globally, the climate system has so much inertia in it now from the emissions that we've put in the system that it's not going to stop. It's not going to start cooling right away. So even if we were to stop emitting greenhouse gases right now, it's going to continue warming for at least the next few decades. And so we can expect these trends to continue regardless of what we do, at least for the near future.
Is there anybody responsible for watching out for marine heat waves? I mean, do we even have a real-time marine heat wave reporting system?
Not really, and that's something that needs to be, or it would be great if it was tackled. In the tropics, I would say that they've been looking at extreme ocean temperatures and thinking about these for much longer than, say, the mid-latitudes or the higher latitudes. And they are certainly aware of extreme temperatures in the tropics because of its impact on coral. So there are some programs like Coral Reef Watch that's run out of NOAA that does exactly what you're saying. They have real-time monitoring of ocean temperatures across the tropics, but it's not more broad than that. It doesn't function for the mid-latitude regions. So that's something that it will be really good to implement, both real-time, but also hooking this definition of what a marine heat wave is into our forecast systems, because we have seasonal forecast systems that can give us some confidence about ocean temperatures 2, 3, 4, 6 months from now.
I didn't know that, and it would be interesting to see ocean forecasts. And one last question, and I don't want to be too dramatic here, but is there a possibility we'll get to the point of unexpected disasters for marine life due to a marine heat wave?
Well, I think we've actually already seen that in some regions. I mean, that kelp forest collapse being replaced by seagrass meadows on the west coast of Australia was absolutely unexpected. And I don't think it's been so disastrous for humans, but I think it was quite disastrous for some of the marine creatures living there. In 2012, there was one of these events that occurred here off the east coast of Canada and the U.S., and water temperatures in the spring were very high, anomalously high, and this caused the lobster fishery to unexpectedly have a massive increase in the number of landings earlier than usual. So the lobsters flooded the industry, flooded the system, and there was an unexpected drop in price. And there were a whole range of downstream effects on that, which led to economic and political tensions between Canada and the U.S. So I would say we're already seeing little hints of these kind of tensions and unexpected consequences arising.
We have been talking with Dr. Eric Oliver about the totally underreported phenomenon of marine heat waves. Eric and 14 other scientists from around the world have released an important new study in Nature Communications. The title is Longer and More Frequent Marine Heat Waves Over the Past Century. You can find links to the paper and this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Eric, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The world's biggest structure built by living organisms is not Tokyo or New York. It is the Great Barrier Reef off Queensland, Australia, in the Coral Sea. It is over 1,400 miles long, 2,300 kilometers. It is a nursery for countless ocean species. And, as we learn in a horrifying new scientific report, the Great Barrier Reef is dying, killed by the hot seas of global warming. The title of the new paper published in the journal Nature is Global Warming Transforms Coral Reef Assemblages. We have reached co-author Dr. C. Mark Eakin. Mark is the coordinator of the Coral Reef Watch, run by NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And as they say at that site, NOAA's Coral Reef Watch provides the only source of satellite-based monitoring, alerts, and warnings of upcoming coral mass bleaching events. From Maryland, Mark Eakin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
I've just spoken with Dr. Eric Oliver, whose team published a paper on global increases of marine heat waves. Tell us what happened to the sea temperatures off Queensland's coast of Australia in 2016.
Yes, and in fact, that's a very good paper to have come out just before our paper, because that's what we were looking at, is one of these marine heat waves, actually two of them, that struck Australia's Great Barrier Reef. This was, in fact, part of a global coral mass bleaching event. This was the third global bleaching event to ever occur. The first was in 1998, the second in 2010, and this one surprisingly lasted for 3 years, from 2014 to 2017, including the two events on the Great Barrier Reef in 2016 and 2017. So in 2016, the Great Barrier Reef was hit by one of these marine heat waves, striking mostly the northern and far northern part of the Great Barrier Reef. That section, unfortunately for the corals, was one that had never seen heat stress like this before. So these sort of marine heat waves had not hit the northern Great Barrier Reef, and the corals were much more sensitive than most corals are because they hadn't been exposed to these kinds of conditions. And so the heat wave struck. We had mass coral bleaching and mortality. And in fact, the corals up there in the northern section were bleaching and dying at about half the level of heat stress that we usually see.
And how did this team and this project get going?
So the work being done in Australia is a part of ongoing efforts through James Cook University, the Australian Research Council Center of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies, the Australian Institute of Marine Science, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, and they have efforts going on to study coral reefs on the Great Barrier Reef on an ongoing basis. And in fact, Australian Institute of Marine Science has, in the past, when these large-scale bleaching events have hit in Australia, two of them being in 98 and 2002, they had used overflights, aircraft overflights, to see how much bleaching there was, as well as having divers who go out and look in the water to see what the after effects were, going out months later to see how much coral may have died. At the same time, NOAA's Coral Reef Watch that I run is an organization that's always monitoring for coral bleaching everywhere in the world, using a combination of satellite monitoring as well as climate models. And so since we have the data on the amount of heat stress that the corals exhibited, they had the data from the work, both the aerial surveys and now the in-water surveys, to understand how much coral had bleached and died. We worked together on this paper. It's actually the third of the papers that we've worked together on regarding these bleaching events.
Now, you say it was pretty well a three-year event of ocean heating, but I was pretty shocked at the figures that came out from just the 2016 period. I mean, your paper lists almost 4,000 different reefs. How much was lost in that period just in 2016?
In 2016 alone, the Great Barrier Reef lost just under 30% of its corals. So it's a huge number of corals. And, you know, most of that, because the majority of the heat and the most sensitive corals were both together in the northern part, the majority of the corals that died in 2016 were up in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef.
Which happens to be a huge tourism area, so people expecting to see bright coral will still see some, I'm told by the Australians, but less and less as we go on. I wanted to talk about two different ways these changes show up that you talk about in the paper. The first is something called three-dimensionality. What does that mean?
Well, coral reefs are very important because they provide habitats for so many different animals. And they do that by forming structure. So, you know, grass is a plant. Trees are plants. But grass and trees provide different kind of structure to animals that live in them. And coral reefs are the same way. Coral reefs provide that three-dimensional structures like trees do. So coral reefs actually serve very much the same way that forests do in providing a lot of structure. And so it's those corals that provide, you know, the corals that grow up in branching forms and tabular forms and really provide that relief that are the ones that provide the most and the most variety of habitat for other animals. And in fact, it's those fast-growing corals, the ones that provide most of that structure, are the ones that were hit the hardest.
Now, when they die, do they just topple over, or do they have to be hit by storms, or how do they lose that dimensionality?
Well, you're right. In one case, it is that they will be hit by storms, and they'll be weakened at that point. The other thing, and some other work that we've been doing with additional colleagues, has found that when these events happen, you actually very quickly start seeing bioerosion or the breakdown of the reef by natural processes. Every coral reef is a balance between processes to build the reef and destroy the reef. I mean, if that weren't the case, the entire ocean bottom would be covered with coral reef. So coral reefs are constantly being broken down by fish like parrotfish, sea urchins and things that crawl around and scrape away the surface, worms and crabs and types of shellfish like mussels that will bore into the reef, and even sponges and types of algae and bacteria that will make pores inside of the coral. And all of these weaken the structure, break it down, turn reef material into sand, and that's how you get a lot of the sand on the beaches, especially along the Great Barrier Reef. The shoreline is covered with the sand that's been formed by corals. But all of these forces will start to take over and will very quickly start breaking things down. In fact, in Hawaii, as a part of a bleaching we had in 2014 in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, we saw a dramatic reduction in the amount of structure on that reef in under a year.
So a lot of those creatures that you've been talking about, I guess, are the second aspect discussed in the paper, which is labeled ecological functioning. Do you want to talk about that briefly?
That's right. So if you're going to have a very diverse coral reef ecosystem, first you have to have a variety of habitats formed by a diverse group of corals. If you have nothing but the same corals, and in fact the ones that survive best are these massive or boulder corals, they just look like big rocks. They don't provide a lot of hiding holes for animals on the reef. And so when you have all these branching structures and tabular structures and folio structures, you know, things that are shaped in all kinds of weird and wonderful shapes, you have all kinds of habitat for animals, whether it's fish, shrimp, crabs, worms, you name it. The Great Barrier Reef, just like any coral reef, is a very diverse habitat. And especially in the north, it's more diverse than the rest of the Great Barrier Reef. And so when these corals die, you immediately start losing some of those fish and other organisms that will no longer have their homes, they'll no longer have the sources of productivity. And so it not only causes a breakdown in the corals themselves, but a breakdown of the actual ecosystem as a whole.
And how much above normal heat did those waters go?
So the way we measure this heat stress is not in degrees, but in something called degree weeks. So if you imagine you have a hot day, that's stressful, but it's one day. Heat waves that cause problem on land and where people, you know, die from heat during heat waves, it's because those events are not only hot, but they continue for days and days and days. Well, these marine heat waves are lasting for weeks to even a few months. And during that time, the temperature is above normal. So if you have temperatures that are, say, 2 degrees Celsius above the normal warmest month temperature, then we will measure that as 2 degree weeks of stress. If the following week you have another week of 2 degrees, then you're now up to 4 degree weeks of stress. Normally, though, it doesn't go at levels quite that high. The temperatures usually during these events are in the range of 1 to 2 degrees Celsius above the normal maximum. And so when we add these up, you get values of heat stress that normally at 4 degree weeks of stress, you see significant bleaching. And at 8 degree weeks of stress, you see widespread bleaching and significant mortality. In this event, in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef, they were seeing bleaching at 2 degree weeks of stress and starting to see mortality as, in some cases, as low as 3 degree weeks of stress. So they were really being affected at a lower level than we're used to.
But I would presume that's because they're closer to the tropics, so that there is less normal variation, whereas as you get towards the poles, there is more variation, so maybe the creatures are more used to it.
Well, that's true, but it's not a matter of variation that we're talking about here. It's how much warmer it is than normal. So, you know, there are coral reefs in places that have a lot of variability. I mean, you know, places like Florida, you know, temperatures will swing much more up and down than they will in the southern Caribbean. Same thing on the Great Barrier Reef. When you get to the southern Great Barrier Reef, which, of course, is closer to the pole, they have more temperature variation normally than they do in the northern Great Barrier Reef, which is near the equator. But the concern isn't that total amount of variability, but how far they get above that upper limit that the corals are used to.
Were there particular conditions like an El Nino or La Nina or something else that led to this long-standing marine heat wave off the coast of Australia?
There was. In fact, that was a part of what was going on in this global bleaching event. We usually see the most bleaching going on during the second year of an El Nino. And in fact, I mentioned those previous global bleaching events. The 98 event and the 2010 event were both in years, in the second year of an El Nino. Well, in 2014, we started seeing a lot of heat stress, and we saw what looked like was going to be an El Nino. We were expecting a 2014-2015 El Nino. The ocean heated up in ways that looked like an El Nino, but the atmosphere never responded, and you need to have both in place to kick in and really form an El Nino. So as a result, there wasn't a 2014-2015 El Nino. We joke about it being the El No-Show. But in 2015, then it started up again. We had the heat in the ocean. The atmosphere responded. And we had a 2015-2016 El Nino. And so what you're seeing at this point was that this El Nino was in place when the bleaching occurred in 2016. Now, interestingly enough, that stopped. We switched into La Nina conditions, and the 2017 marine heat wave the next year in Australia occurred during La Nina conditions. So one of the things that's important here is that we're no longer just seeing these things driven by El Nino or La Nina, but instead the warming that's gone on as a part of climate change has increased the temperatures of the ocean so that they're close to those thermal limits already. So it takes very little to push it over the top.
So, Mark, looking into your own private research, separate from this paper, I want to ask you, aside from the global warming caused by our greenhouse gases, does the presence of more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere affect coral directly?
It does, but in a secondary way. Corals build their skeletons of calcium carbonate, in other words, limestone. To do that, they have to have plenty of carbonate in the water. That is something that is harder for the corals to build their skeletons out of calcium carbonate when the water is more acidic. When you have more acid in the water, they don't build their skeletons as well. And the organisms that will naturally erode coral reefs are able to do that even faster. So when we have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, more carbon dioxide goes into the water. That carbon dioxide dissociates and becomes carbonic acid, and it's a more acidic condition that's harder for corals to build their skeletons and easier for organisms like boring sponges and such to erode the reef. It's not something, though, that has a major effect on bleaching. There is some effect in some corals. It's been shown that some corals become more sensitive to high temperatures when the water is more acidic, but it's not true of all corals. In fact, we're not really sure just how widespread that is. Most corals do grow more slowly, but that really comes into play after an event like this, and you're looking to see how well the reef can recover.
In June 2016, as this disaster unfolded, I interviewed the world's greatest coral expert, Charlie Varon. He'd just flown back from looking at the reefs, his life work of exploring and cataloging the wonderful world of coral was being killed off. How are Australian scientists you've worked with taking this terrible news about the coral?
Oh, well, they've been living through it. It's been a bit of a nightmare in most cases, where reefs that they've been studying for years have been just completely destroyed. Now, you know, you have to keep in mind, though, that we're not saying the entire Great Barrier Reef is gone. It killed, say, you know, somewhere in the range of about a billion corals, but there's still about a billion corals left on the Great Barrier Reef. 2016, bleaching was mostly on. There was a bit of bleaching farther south, but not too far. The 2017 event then hit more in the central Great Barrier Reef. And the central Great Barrier Reef is more the area where tourists go, and there are a lot of activities. So, you know, between those, there was a lot of destruction. And in fact, in the 2 years combined, the Great Barrier Reef lost about half of all of its corals. So we're looking at an area where a lot of reefs are in bad shape. Some reefs are still surviving. Some corals are still surviving. And so most of the scientists are at the same time trying to document what happened and the problems of that bleaching event while trying to find ways to help the reef recover from these insults.
You know, when the ice, the Arctic sea ice, retreated in 2007 and it was jaw-dropping, it was unexpected, I was really shocked. I thought, all right, this is climate change. But I think this is another one of those events, but it hasn't really made the public consciousness outside of Australia of what is happening there.
Yeah, it's a big problem that people aren't realizing how much climate change is already going on and going on all around them. We never saw mass coral bleaching events before 1983, that really big El Nino that it was occurring then. We never saw global bleaching events until 1998, and these have been increasing in frequency and intensity. Another paper that many members of the same team had in the journal Science about 2 months ago, we were able to analyze records from 100 sites around the world, coral reef sites, and we found that where in the 1980s we were seeing severe bleaching events once every 30 years, now we're seeing them once every 6 years. So this is a real acceleration. One thing that I would encourage your listeners to do if they haven't seen it yet and want to know more about this is watch the film Chasing Coral. You mentioned Charlie Varon. Charlie is in it. I'm in it briefly. I was one of the chief scientific advisors for it. And that film, Chasing Coral, really does a wonderful job of showing what's happening to the reefs, but does it while you follow the adventure of filmmakers and scientists and videographers who are trying to capture this bleaching event as it went on. So the 2016 bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef we're talking about right now is actually a major part of that film.
I will track that film down and put a link to it in my blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, the world's largest green radio show on nonprofit stations. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Mark Eakin from NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. We're talking about the latest assessment of coral death in the Great Barrier Reef off Australia's coast. And I think that, you know, is it too much to say that the reef system is becoming dead, or is it damaged? Do we expect recovery?
So what we've seen is the collapse of many of those coral reefs. I mean, you know, you think about what happens if there's, say, a massive forest fire. Every tree isn't dead, but it's no longer functioning as a forest ecosystem. The trees aren't there. They don't provide the same habitats. The productivity isn't there. You have to see if you're going to have that recovery to come back as a forest, and that takes time. And it takes time for reefs to come back as well. Coral reefs that have suffered this sort of widespread coral death, you can start to see recovery in 10 to 15 years as you get a lot of the fastest growing corals coming back. But that's like having that forest fire and then coming back with shrubs. They're part of the process. They do provide cover, but they're not the whole thing. You've lost your big old trees, or in this case, your big old corals as well. And corals that take decades to centuries to grow in the first place take decades to centuries to recover as well. So yes, reefs can recover, but as I was saying, that recent paper we had in Science says that we're looking at the return of severe bleaching events once every 6 years, but yet even for that initial growth of coral cover, it takes 10 to 15. So we already are at a point where the recovery is taking longer than the return time of the events.
So now with this new paper in Nature, we do have a big red alarm flashing about a collapse in our environment. Is there anything to be done about this?
There is. There are very important things we need to be doing. And it's important that we all keep in mind that those of us who are working with this on a daily basis and realize how bad it is, we haven't given up hope. We certainly believe that we're going to have coral reefs in the future if we do our part and allow the reefs to do theirs. So what are some of those things? The first is we need to be dealing with climate change. The Paris Agreement calls for keeping temperature increase around the globe, the global average, to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial conditions. And it has a second target that it calls for efforts to keep long-term temperatures at 1.5 degrees or below. Well, actually, for coral reefs, 1.5 is what we need. Anything above 1.5 is going to be bad for reefs. Anything above 2 is going to be catastrophic. And so we need to be working on dealing with climate change by reducing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You'll notice I didn't say reducing emissions, because it's not about just removing emissions. We also need to be thinking about negative emissions. How can we pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and clean up that part of our air that has been polluted but we just can't see? The next thing, though, is we need to be reducing local stress. Problems like land-based sources of pollution, you know, runoff of fertilizer, nutrients, runoff of sediments from poor land use. You know, these are all problems that have been facing coral reefs and continue to. Overfishing or destructive practices of fishing, habitat destruction, you know, these are all really important things. And by reducing those stressors, it helps the reefs have a better chance of recovering. But now we need to be looking at some much more dramatic things. And in Australia, they're even looking at installing large fans that, you know, big propellers that will draw cooler water up and pump it onto the reefs at time that that the bleaching is going on. There also is talk about ships that will spray seawater into the air, producing low-level boundary, you know, marine boundary layer clouds that can shade and cool the waters. So, you know, there are some actual direct actions we can take. The other one is the work that's going on coral restoration. The coral nurseries have been a great advance, especially for growing fast-growing corals, and there's some wonderful efforts underway. But one of the problems there is you never restore a habitat until you've removed the problem that killed things in the first place. And here with climate change, we're continuing to see that rising temperature. So there are teams that are working on selectively breeding corals that are better able to survive the future and using those as a part of these restoration activities. So there's a whole suite of things that are either underway or being contemplated that we need to be taking care of. But if we don't deal with that first one, if we don't address climate change, we shouldn't even bother with the rest.
And I would add one more thing. Let's not build a great big coal shipping port right near the reef as well, but We'll see whether that ever happens. How do our listeners find Coral Reef Watch, and how do they use it when they get there?
So Coral Reef Watch is easy to find online. It's coralreefwatch.noaa.gov. You can also find us at Coral Reef Watch on Twitter and Facebook. Most of our tools and materials are available on the website. You can go in there, and there are maps showing where the heat stress is potentially causing coral bleaching all around the world right now. There are detailed maps and tools with things like the gauges, like you see a fire danger when you go into a forest. We have bleaching danger gauges on the pages for different places. So whether you want to know about the Great Barrier Reef, whether you want to know about Florida, whether you want to know about Hawaii, you know, all of these are places that you can look at and see what the current heat stress levels are and what the climate models tell us are likely to be seeing in the about 4 months out. We can predict about 4 months ahead with pretty good accuracy. And so they can go through and do all of that. And if they live near a reef or have a reef they're particularly concerned about, they can sign up for email alerts, and they'll be alerted only when there's a change in the heat stress level on those reefs. And so we do this for all around the world. It's not just the U.S. So, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, Sri Lanka, Kiribati, or Florida, it's all the same.
One last thing. You just returned from Puerto Rico after yet another island-wide blackout, and that was the scene of a super hurricane, which we think climate change added to it. What is your sense of the feeling that people had there when the lights went out again?
Oh, again? They've become rather resigned to it. There was, in fact, just an outage that occurred last week that took out the power to 850 or 900,000 people in San Juan. This was bigger. It took out the power grid for the entire island. You're dealing with a Commonwealth of the U.S. that is not treated as though it's part of the U.S. It also is an area that is very poor and has very limited infrastructure by U.S. standards. So they don't have a very robust power grid, and so when power goes out, it's a lot tougher. So there's a lot that needs to be done there, and they know it. But they're also dealing with big, major economic problems that preceded the hurricane. So they're working through it, and they're trying to get help from people to deal with things, while at the same time they're still, you know, there are people without roofs and people who have not had power since Hurricane Maria came through last year, and we're just a little more than a month away from the beginning of the next hurricane season.
Well, to the people of Puerto Rico, we love you, and really we have the responsibility that these storms have become so extreme, in my opinion, because of our longstanding greenhouse gas emissions. But really, we've been talking about coral throughout this, and especially I want to encourage people to go and visit Coral Reef Watch. Our guest, Dr. Mark Eakin, is the coordinator of NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. He's the author of the paper published April 18th, 2018, co-author, I should say, in the journal Nature, titled Global Warming Transforms Coral Reef Assemblages. There's a lot to it. I encourage you to go and look at it. The lead author is Professor Terry P. Hughes, and he is from the ARC Center of Excellence Coral Reef Studies in Australia. Find links to the science and this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your busy time with us.
Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to spend that time with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In the science world, there's a growing awareness of the dangers of extremes. If rains increase a little or decrease a little, nature adjusts. A little hotter and we all get by, even as the normal base continues to warm as each decade passes. But extreme precipitation events are blowing in across the globe, while elsewhere droughts last longer, forest fires burn earlier, later, and then all year round. As our guest Eric Oliver told us, there is no global monitoring system for marine heat waves. Just this week, a bottlenose dolphin was spotted in what should have been the cold waters off Vancouver Island on Canada's west coast. That should never happen. We need a marine warning system for the subtropics, where most of us live, as provided now for the tropics by NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. All of us on land should be told what is happening in the seas, along with our weather forecasts. We need to see the maps. The public hardly knows it, but marine heat waves may be the next big thing.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
My listeners educate me, as do my guests. Feel free to write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. You can help the future. Please pass on this radio show through social media and wherever you travel on the Internet. And keep supporting your local nonprofit radio station. They keep this vital information beaming out. I'm Alex Smith. Join us again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to talk today to the president of Azad Kashmir and it's a very important story, long neglected by the media here. That's why we do the Taylor Report, as you know. And we also expect to be talking sometime soon, shortly, with Captain John Turnbull of the Freedom boat, the vessel, the sailing boat that went to, attempted to reach the port of Gaza, was intercepted, boarded in international waters. It's a very important story. I don't think it's been in the Globe. I know it hasn't been in the Star. I doubt that it's been in CBC. A captain of an experienced sailor has been boarded by the Israelis. Well, I think I'm going on too long. We have, I think, Captain John Turnbull with us. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
Hello. Thank you for joining us. You were the captain of the, you're minus a ship these days, but you were sailing in a ship called the Freedom under a Swedish flag, if I have it right, and were in international waters when you were boarded by the Israeli, I guess, defense forces. Can you tell us what happened, why you were there, and what happened?
Sure. Well, the why I was there is a little more interesting than what actually happened. I was there to try to demonstrate, not so much to the Israeli government, but to the governments of Europe and my own government in Canada, our own government in Canada, that we believe a blockade is wrong. I think it's wrong legally. That gets into some fine detail that we don't necessarily need right now. But I think it's wrong morally. It's been in place for 12 years. It's a punishment of civilians. It's a collective punishment of civilians. It's unnecessary. And it simply extends a rather perverse interdependency between Hamas and the Israeli Defense Forces. Mm-hmm. So we've thought for some years that it should be broken, and sailing a boat of any kind into it and forcing our governments to pay attention to this issue is what we've been trying to do. And it's been increasingly successful. This has gone on since about 2007 or 8 when there was an original Jewish boat to Gaza, mm-hmm. which left Israel and sailed south. You may recall the 2010 incident with the Mavi Marmara, where 10 people were killed in a rather large ship, killed by people rappelling down from helicopters in the dark. Mm-hmm. It was an incredibly dumb move militarily. Mm-hmm. And the year after that, my wife, Karen DeVito, participated in the 2011 campaign, a mainly Canadian campaign.
You're from a sailing family.
Well, yes. Yeah, we can't stay away from the boats. So this is just one of a series. This my experience this year with the sailing ship Freedom, and with its companion in the flotilla, a Norwegian fishing boat. This is just the latest of a series of attempts to break this blockade.
What did you have aboard? You had 10 passengers. Did you have material? And what were you intending? What would you have done if had you been allowed to go through?
Well, yeah, that was a question we asked many times as we approached the Port of Gaza. As it happens, the Port of Gaza is not very deep. They can't afford to dredge it. And we probably would have run aground in a sort of embarrassing way just inside the harbor. Yeah, it would not have been a problem. It's a sand bottom. But we were amused by that possibility. We had aboard some medical supplies. And this amounted to perhaps several hundred dollars worth of dressings for wounds, various kinds of bandages, and the kind of stuff that a hospital goes through on a daily basis, particularly a hospital like the ones in Gaza that are dealing now with hundreds, in fact, I think about 4,000 woundings of people by sniper fire. But I do want to emphasize that the medical stuff we took was kind of a side issue. It's a little bit like taking a bottle of wine when your friends invite you to dinner. It was a courtesy. It's not enough medical stuff to really make a difference. It was as much as we could store in the sailboat. But it really is just a courtesy. The real issue is that Gaza is perfectly capable of having an economy that could pay for hospitals. It turns out doctors by the dozens. It's a very sophisticated, well-educated place that if it had a port and if it had access to the rest of the world, as every other port city in the world does, it would have an economy that would keep people prosperous and happy.
Yes. I've seen a statement by yourself that made a point that I hadn't realized. It said that this port in Gaza is the only closed port in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, I think that's true. Somebody may come up with some other minor port, but, you know, we visited a lot of ports between Gothenburg in Sweden, where the boat originated, and nearly Gaza. You know, every port you come into, it's clear that there's a whole lot of money changing hands. There's a whole lot of movement and cargo, and that the life of the city and the economy of the country, of course, we all know this from our geography lessons in high school, that all depends on access to ports and to close a port. Just imagine for a moment that even the port of Toronto, which is not as active as it used to be, but imagine closing that port. Imagine closing the port of Halifax.
Yes.
And surrounding the city of Halifax with a wire fence and then shooting at people in Halifax. The world would be outraged. Mm-hmm. And it baffles me that the world is not outraged at this atrocity.
Yeah. We're speaking to Captain John Turnbull. By the way, it's a sailing vessel. That was rather unique for boarding, and there's a little more some issues there of safety of people, right? It's not so simple for a motorized vehicle to come alongside a sailing ship because a sailing ship is kind of a little different. Did you have concerns in that way?
Oh, I did, yeah. We were all lucky, but the Israelis particularly were lucky, that it was a fairly quiet night. We had very strong winds on the way in. They settled down as evening approached, as often happens in the Mediterranean. And so we only had about 8 or 10 knots of wind, and a boat, quite a heavy boat, was only doing about 4 or 5 knots. Fairly stable, fairly level on deck. I have to say, the Israelis have learned to play this game after making some really dumb moves early on. They've figured out how to come alongside with diesel-powered, inflated, essentially landing craft with platforms on the front, and they kind of stream aboard with their guns and a bullhorn. You know, this was not the first contact, of course, but as these boats approached on either side of us from astern, it kind of pinched in at our beam, and the bullhorn said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we are the Israeli Navy. We come in peace." Uh-huh. And we all laughed. Uh-huh. The 12 of us aboard just had a good, hearty laugh about that, because the next thing that happened, of course, was that about 20 soldiers, 10 from each side, boarded the boat with their with their rifles and sidearms.
Yeah. Of course, by the way, you were already there in peace. You know, I like the expression that we learned actually in previous interviews with others who have been making these attempts to break the illegal blockade of Gaza. There's a conversation that takes place, and I know that the captains have said, we are in international waters, and this is we have the right of innocent passage. Did you have any such exchange? Where is that from? You also cite the Law of the Sea of 1982 in terms of your own position, that you're not nothing you were doing was illegal.
Yeah. No, I do believe that, and I believe lots of lawyers have looked at it that way as well. I think it's uniquely Israel that sees this as a legal act. Now, mind you, the law of blockade is set up by naval powers for their own good. It was never meant to allow, colonialized countries like this get away with anything. Mm-hmm. So it's a way for naval powers to kind of keep out of each other's way. But blockades were always, like occupations, were always considered to be temporary, subject to military advantage or military strategy. They were never, ever used, to my knowledge anyway, to imprison 2 million people for 12 years. That's not what a blockade is for. Mm-hmm. Even the blockade of Cuba was selective.
Yes. Yes.
It did not punish Cuban civilians.
Yes.
So, we had that typical exchange. It was about 7 o'clock when the VHF crackled, and I had a moment of satisfaction when I told them what channel to go to. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, you wait for the caller to say, go to whatever from 16. I said, go to 72. Uh-huh. I went to 72 and thought, they won't do this, will it? But they did. Yeah. So I thought, there's a little victory.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the typical conventional exchange of identity that you expect from a VHF call. What's your vessel? What are your call signs? But then when they began asking about the number of crew and all that kind of stuff, I said, what's the intent of this call? And why are you querying a yacht, a private yacht, in international waters? And it was at that point, more or less, that they kind of read the Riot Act to us, which I think was pre-recorded, by the way.
When you say the Riot Act, does that mean, do they assert their right as a military? Is they say it's for security? Or what's their excuse?
Yeah, they say this is, they identify themselves as the Israeli Navy. They say you're entering a closed military zone. So the language is very much like the language of areas A and B in the West Bank, where they say the same thing. It's a closed military zone. In other words, the military's taken it over, and you just have to go away. Now, this is a bizarre claim in international waters, especially international waters so close to the Suez Canal, where all kinds of ships pass doing their business every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Riot Act I refer to, and I put that in quotes, basically says you're entering a closed military zone, you risk confiscation of your vessel, which, by the way, is not in the law of blockade, And they read you that one, and then when you say no thanks, as I did, then they read you a sort of more stern message as well. And at that point, the radio is shut down. You know that they can't hear you, although I called many times to say this is a complex vessel. Boarding it will be dangerous for your troops as well as for our crew. Please tell me what your intentions are. This was sincere. It really is difficult, as you pointed out earlier, to board a sailboat at night. But there was no response to that. And then we found that about an hour and a half later, in the dark by this time, we had lights at all of the cardinal and intercardinal points around the boat, and these began to move in. And then finally, these two very large inflatables came up behind us, and they boarded.
This is Captain John Turnbull from Vancouver. And have you talked to us about the media? Why isn't this being covered? Have you heard from the CBC or the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star? Are they doing a story on this?
No, not yet. No, I did just get myself a telephone number in France, so I've been a little hard to reach. Maybe they're trying, if you're out there.
I could give them some tips on how to do this.
I think you know what you're doing there.
And the government, it sounds in a way, it sounds like they had a little bit of a kerfuffle with the earlier ship, and there were some Canadian trade unionists, and one of them ended up in rather poor condition and whatnot. Didn't go so smoothly, but they seemed to want to avoid legal matters. I mean, is it true that they decided you didn't get charged with anything, right? They simply passed you through on the say-so of the Canadian representative?
Yeah, the Israeli law on this is odd, and this will sound a little bit bizarre and Kafkaesque. It is all of that. But the Israeli law is a law of deportation, and it specifies that somebody who wants to stay in Israel but is being deported can stay a certain number of hours, in this case 72 hours, to kind of put together their affairs and collect their salary before they go. Mm-hmm. We're, of course, in the exact opposite situation. We don't want to be there. And for their part, the Israeli government really doesn't want us there either, because the longer we're there, the more shameful it is. You know,
yes.
Imagine the headlines if I'd been in prison for some time. And so there's this odd tension. In the end, the decision to let us go had nothing to do with the efforts of our Canadian bureaucracy, although I praise their efforts. I'm very grateful for what they tried to do. What it had to do with was the availability of prison guards and overtime, and did they have a truck, and was mm-hmm. it today, and was there a flight? It was all very much a matter of mundane practicality. Had nothing to do with their process, and not much to do with pressure from the diplomats.
Yeah. It would have helped that the foreign minister had tweeted something on your behalf.
Well, you know, the embassy there operates at two levels, and I don't fault them. Well, I fault them for operating at the level of support for Israel, but I don't fault them for operating at two diplomatic levels.
Mm-hmm.
The consul did her level best to come to the prison, interview me, make sure that I was healthy, and then attempt to get me out quickly to a place I wanted to go. She did her very best, and she did mm-hmm. a good job. However, the Israelis were absolutely coy about my condition and what I had expressed in terms of my desire to get out within a particular time. There's a document that you sign that kind of waives your right to stay. And every time I saw the opportunity to sign this document, well, the Israeli immigration fellow just wasn't available. So there was a game being played there, mm-hmm. which I just had to accept. After all, I was behind a steel door almost the entire time I was there.
Yeah. I really liked the effort, and also in your previous interviews and elsewhere, you remind the world that the Palestinians have been in this situation for 70 years. Gaza for, this blockade's been 12, but their lives are horrendous.
Yeah, and I do want to make that point, if you don't mind my stressing it again, and thank you for pointing it out. This, you know, the story of my imprisonment and sailing about and all that is a great dinner conversation, and I can tell you some funny stories that happened, and I won't do that now. Because the real story is about 6.5 million people, Palestinians, 6.5 million of them, who in the West Bank are in a medium security prison. They can't mm-hmm. come in or out without permission of the Israeli border guard, and they don't often get it. Some of them are in prisons within that prison, literally prison buildings. They are political prisoners, and many of them, a significant number, are children.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's Gaza, which is just a gigantic 2 million-person prison camp into which the IDF uses sniper fire to combat the danger of a peaceful demonstration, a march against the fence. Mm-hmm. If this happened in Poland, yeah. or in Romania, as it did
Ukraine,
some years ago,
yeah.
or the Ukraine, or anywhere else, the world would be outraged.
Yes,
if children were being killed in this manner, this is not warfare.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a natural disaster. It is a policy of a government that is allied with our Canadian government, and it disgusts me to have to say this, that our government supports this nonsense at that diplomatic level that I mentioned earlier, because, of course, while the consul is doing her best to get me out of Israel, the mm-hmm. embassy itself is working very hard to create ties between Canadian academic and technical institutions, trade, etc. This is terrifying that we're doing this for a country which by policy is killing a million children with poisoned water.
Yeah. Well, John Turnbull, I based on what you said, I know you were satisfied with your effort. I know that Freedom Flotilla is an inspiring group of people. And we thank you very, very much for talking to us. And we want to talk to you in the future because, as we both know, this is going to go on for a while.
I'm afraid it is. So I look forward to talking to you again about it. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.
That is Captain John Turnbull of the Freedom. It is a sailing vessel. We're going to take a break, and very short one, and we're going to come back with an interview with the president of Azad Kashmir.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who discusses the rising civilian death toll in the Yemen war, where 40 children in a bus were recently killed by a U.S.-supported Saudi airstrike. Anti-nuclear activist Mark Colville, who explains how he and his six fellow Plowshares defendants plan to defend themselves against charges they face for their symbolic protest against nuclear weapons at Georgia's King Bay Naval Base. And Andrew Linhart of the Sierra Club, who takes a critical look at the Trump administration's plan to roll back Obama-era auto fuel efficiency and pollution standards. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During his brief tenure as Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson made enemies of two powerful allies in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The Persian Gulf states were upset over Tillerson's efforts to mediate the Saudi-led blockade against Qatar. The Intercept reports that in the summer of 2017, Saudi Arabia and key Gulf allies faced Tillerson's opposition to their plans to invade Qatar. As CEO of ExxonMobil, Tillerson developed close ties with Qatari officials. As Secretary of State, Tillerson urged King Salman and other top Saudi officials to reduce tensions with Qatar. The invasion plan, revealed by Qatari intelligence agents just weeks before it was set to be carried out, called for Saudi troops to cross the border into Qatar with military support from the UAE. According to a source close to the Emirati royal family and another source who is close to the Saudi royal family, beginning in the fall of 2017, the crown princes of both Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi began lobbying the Trump White House for Tillerson's removal. In recent years, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have worked together to militarily intervene in the region, including deploying troops to Bahrain during the Arab Spring protests in 2011 and launching the brutal war in Yemen. In the weeks after Hurricane Maria decimated Puerto Rico, inmates at the Bayamon Correctional Facility were cut off from water, electricity, and isolated from family members for weeks. The difficulties inflicted on inmates in the Commonwealth's jails spiked after Puerto Rico's unelected financial control board, known as La Junta, imposed broad austerity measures, including severe cuts in public education. Hidden inside the plan was a scheme to transfer one-third of the island's prison population to private jails in the United States mainland. The plan, which supporters claim will save $400 million, faces strong opposition from inmates and prison reformers. William Ramirez of the American Civil Liberties Union chapter in Puerto Rico blasted the correction scheme as government-sponsored human trafficking, being undertaken in the name of profit since inmates as wards of the state cannot freely provide consent for their transfer. For over 20 years, Puerto Rican officials have tried and failed to move inmates to U.S. prisons. 500 Puerto Rican prisoners were transferred to Minnesota in 1993, but were returned 2 years later after complaints about substandard conditions at the jail. 480 of the island's prisoners were moved to Oklahoma in 2012, but that program was scuttled a year later after Puerto Rican inmates rioted at the facility. Billionaire Steve Cohen's hedge fund company, SAC Capital, pled guilty to insider trading charges in 2013 and paid $1.8 billion in penalties. But Cohen, who eluded criminal charges himself, now runs a private fund with $11 billion in assets. After his son served in Afghanistan, he's taken an interest in veterans' healthcare issues, specifically post-traumatic stress disorder. His nonprofit, Cohen Veterans Network, has won support from congressional Republicans who want to promote the privatization of veterans' healthcare as an alternative to the federally operated Veterans Administration. ProPublica reports that veterans' clinics run by Cohen's network have a mixed record, including accusations of cherry-picking patients and mismanagement. Controversy surrounded Cohen's first clinic at New York University over questions raised about who controlled patent rights to medical research that Cohen financed. More recently, Cohen backed an aggressive lobbying campaign to secure government reimbursements for his veterans' clinics, which were initially advertised as free to patients. Cohen, who contributed $1 million to Trump's inauguration fund and another $1 million to the House Republican Super PAC in April 2017, succeeded in bypassing congressional opposition when he eventually was approved to receive reimbursements from the VA. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the latest carnage witnessed in Yemen's ongoing brutal war, 51 civilians were killed, 40 of them children, when on August 9th, a Saudi airstrike targeted a bus carrying young students who were on a school recreational field trip in the northern province of Sada. While Saudi officials claim they never deliberately target civilians, human rights groups accuse the Saudi-led military coalition of indiscriminately bombing schools, hospitals, markets, and residential neighborhoods. During the course of the war, the U.S. has provided the Saudi military coalition, comprised of 9 Middle Eastern and African nations, with intelligence, logistics, and air refueling support. Local journalists at the scene of the school bus bombing report that they found fragments of a U.S.-made Mark 82 bomb used in the attack, which is jointly manufactured by Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics. Saudi Arabia and its allies, who buy billions of dollars worth of weapons from the U.S., Britain, and France, has waged a campaign against Yemen's Houthi rebels since early 2015. The coalition says it's fighting to counter the regional influence of the Houthis' ally, Iran. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who discusses the rising civilian death toll in Yemen and the effort by some members of the U.S. House of Representatives to end U.S. involvement in Yemen's war that has killed as many as 50,000 and displaced more than 3 million.
Well, the school bus was carrying children on their field trip, and one little boy on the bus had actually taken footage of the kids, you know, doing what kids do on a bus. They're giggling and kind of moving around and getting a chance to talk with each other. And now that little boy who filmed it was killed, but his cell phone was retrieved, and CNN showed that video footage. They were kids who were looking forward for days to this holiday that they were going to get to take, going to a grassy area for a picnic following the summer school they'd been in, which was for religious studies. The Saudis initially said, no, there were no children on that bus. And now they've said, well, we'll do an investigation. But it seems to me highly inadequate to say, oh, okay, the Saudis will investigate this situation, because already the Saudi king has issued a pardon for any Saudi military person's activities that might in any way be seen to be wrongdoing. He's just absolved them all in advance. We've found that in the past, when the Saudis targeted and hit a Doctors Without Borders hospital, they said, well, we'll ask our American counterparts for better guidance. Well, the United States had just hit, 3 weeks earlier, a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan. So that might have been even a bit tongue-in-cheek. And, you know, at this point, trying to understand the extent of suffering the Saudis are causing. You know, I think certainly the parents and the relatives and friends of those children and the traumatized survivors of the killing and bloodshed when the bus was hit is front and center in our minds. But in June of this past summer, the Doctors Without Borders had just finished completing a center for treatment of cholera, and they're anticipating a third epidemic wave of cholera, and the Saudis bombed that.
There was a very disturbing news report that emerged recently that talked about the Saudi-led coalition battling Houthi rebels in Yemen, secured secret deals with al-Qaeda in Yemen, and recruited hundreds of the group's fighters to assist them in their battle against the Houthis. What can you tell us about this deal-making that's going on between the Saudi-led coalition and these terrorist groups?
Well, it seems like the Saudi-led coalition wanted to say, oh, yes, we've rooted all of these al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula fighters. But then it turned out that was hardly the case. They paid some of the commanders really handsome sums of money, and they gave safe passage to convoys of these fighters who were moving out. And they, at one place, there was even a farewell dinner for them. I think the United States perhaps isn't going to want it to be well known that its supposed partners in fighting the war on terror are actually in some ways linked up with the people that are supposedly the terrorists, and that they then say, well, you know, if you want, you can come and work for us. How would that be? And then recruit them into their armed services. I mean, you don't find very many Saudi military people on the ground in Yemen doing the fighting. They've bought people over from amongst the Janjaweed fighters in South Sudan. They've bought people that are desperate from other African countries in to do the fighting, and now they're trying to recruit al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, former fighters.
Earlier this year, members of the House of Representatives, bipartisan group of congresspeople, got together and put forward some measures that would put them on record as being opposed to the U.S. involvement in the Yemen war. What is the current status of efforts to continue opposition to what the Trump administration is doing in aiding the Saudi coalition in Yemen?
Well, Representative Ro Khanna in California and Representative Barbara Lee, I'm hoping, will press forward with one piece of legislation, House Resolution 81, which is still on the books. It would be possible to get more co-sponsors. But, you know, that Resolution 81 could have gone forward for a vote, but instead the Democratic whip, Steny Hoyer, decided that he would put forth a different resolution, which was a non-binding resolution, and it condemned the Saudi war. But because it was non-binding, it didn't mean anything. You know, it was just like if you or I made a statement. And so I think there's a high reluctance to offend the Saudi prince. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman came to the United States. He was treated like royalty. He was met with by every past president of the United States who's alive today. Oprah Winfrey met with him. Heads of showbiz met with him. He went all around the United States making public relations appearances. And then Speaker of the House Paul Ryan organized a delegation to go over to Saudi Arabia, and people shook hands with the Crown Prince, and President Trump's first international trip was to Saudi Arabia. So I think, you know, the Saudi royalty that haven't been locked up by their brother, it's an interesting story. He rounded up his cousins and some of his own brothers and kind of kept them at the Ritz-Carlton until they agreed to turn over vast parts of their fortunes, because I think he is very worried about how he's going to pay for this war that costs $200 million a day.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Learn more about the war in Yemen and U.S. involvement in the conflict by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 4th, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., seven Catholic activists carried out the 100th Plowshares protest action against nuclear weapons, this time at the Kings Bay Naval Station in Georgia, the largest nuclear submarine base in the world. Carrying hammers and bottles of their own blood, the seven symbolically attempted to convert the submarines that carry nuclear weapons. Plowshares actions take their name from the biblical imperative to beat swords into plowshares, and activists focus on nonviolent direct actions against nuclear weapons. After spending a few months in jail, four of the Kings Bay Plowshares participants were bailed out to address personal issues and to organize support for their upcoming trial. Mark Colville, who along with his wife Luz, has run the Amistad Catholic Worker House in New Haven, Connecticut for the past 25 years, served more than a year in prison in the late 1990s for another Plowshares action. He's one of three Plowshares activists who remain in prison. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Colville by phone in jail. After describing prison conditions, no activities or time outdoors and very little opportunity for exercise, he talked about the Plowshares legal case and the arguments their lawyers will be bringing to trial.
There's a preliminary hearing, it's called a motions hearing, and both sides in the case present written motions to the court ahead of time, and the hearing is an opportunity to argue those motions. Sort of the main motion that we had filed was a motion to dismiss the charges. Our argument is based on six reasons why the charges should be dismissed. I'll quickly give you those. One is that nuclear weapons are illegal under U.S. law. Secondly, nuclear weapons are illegal under U.S. and international law. Number three, therefore, the property that is in question that we're accused of damaging is not entitled to protection under the law. Fourth, there's a religious freedom argument, which is kind of interesting, which I can get into. But basically, our necessity to go on the base is rooted in our religious faith. All seven of us are actually Roman Catholics. So we're prepared to make an argument that what we did at Kings Bay was actually a requirement of our faith practice. Then number five was that the prosecutor, the government, is engaged in selective and vindictive prosecution, which is related to the last point, which is that we've been charged with the same offense in more than one count. So actually the charges that we're under are three felonies and a misdemeanor, the misdemeanor being trespassing. The felonies are destruction of government property, depredation of government property, and conspiracy. So basically the arguments we made are kind of interesting. First of all, we're trying to make the point that nuclear weapons are illegal, and really this is the whole point of, large part, it's the point of Plowshares actions, is that there has been no way to get nuclear weapons judged in a court. And we've tried many other ways. And what we find in the federal courts is that clearly the laws are in place, both constitutionally, domestic law as well as international law. Clearly the laws are there that make it clear that nuclear weapons are illegal. The problem is that the way the law is applied in the federal courts, the application of the law essentially puts nuclear weapons beyond the reach of law. Okay? So not only has nobody in 73 years, not only has nobody ever voted for a nuclear weapon or been able to approve or disapprove of one, but their legality has never been really at all challenged in a court of law. And in fact, Plowshares cases are mostly designed to try to change that. And in fact, it's kind of a sad commentary that citizens have to put themselves at such risk, both in terms of physical harm and then of course lengthy jail time, just to change that reality that they've managed to place nuclear weapons beyond the reach of law. So we're trying to argue that our action was necessary based on that. The religious freedom thing is actually, it's kind of ironic that we're actually making a new argument here based on recent development, something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which has really gotten some teeth in the past few years, with Trump being president and even before that. But people may recall that there was a case out in Colorado about so-called Christians refusing to bake a cake for a gay wedding, and that, I guess, went all the way to the Supreme Court. their argument was based on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And basically, the argument is that, or the law says that in cases where the government needs to restrain people who are practicing their religion, that they must do so in the least intrusive way available. And so part of our argument in terms of dismissal was that we didn't need to be charged with three felonies and a misdemeanor for what we did. There are much less restrictive ways of limiting our actions.
That was Mark Colville, one of the Kings Bay Plowshares seven Catholic activists who entered the Kings Bay Naval Station to call for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Supporters are organizing a peace walk from the city of Savannah to Kings Bay, September 3rd through the 14th. For more information on the Kings Bay Plowshares action, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 2nd, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency, along with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, announced their plan to repeal regulations that require automakers that sell cars and light trucks in the U.S. to steadily increase fuel efficiency and reduce pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. Under the Obama administration, automakers were required to nearly double the fuel efficiency of passenger vehicles to an average of 54 miles per gallon by 2025. Instead, the Transportation Department will freeze the standard at the 2021 level to an average 37 miles per gallon. The Trump EPA also says it's revoking the Clean Air Act waiver, which authorizes the state of California to set its own more demanding air quality and fuel efficiency standards. If the California waiver is revoked, California, 13 other states in the District of Columbia would be forced to follow lower federal standards. In response to the Trump move, 17 states in the District of Columbia have already filed a lawsuit asking a federal court to block Trump's rules change. They're challenging the rollback of standards as arbitrary and without evidence justifying their action. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Linhart, Sierra Club Associate Director for Legislative and Administrative Advocacy, who discusses his group's response to the Trump attempt to weaken fuel efficiency and pollution standards.
So one thing I want to emphasize is it's more than just fuel efficiency standards. So the program is actually made up of both the fuel efficiency standard side, which most people are familiar with, but EPA more directly regulates greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles. And that's also what California regulates. So they are focused on reducing those harmful climate pollution, you know, mostly coming in the form of carbon dioxide from vehicle tailpipes. But California and EPA focus on that side, and the Department of Transportation focuses on the fuel efficiency. So it's a little different, but the program's goal are basically the same thing, which is to get more mileage out of every tank of gas that people fill up with. And unfortunately, the Trump administration wants to roll back this whole program. So freezing the standards at the 2020 numbers and getting rid of essentially 6 years of additions. So essentially, it's going to cost people more money on every tank of gas while adding more pollution to the air. So it's really unfortunate, you know, especially with the timing as we're seeing the impacts of climate change across the country. And speaking of California with that, you know, the devastating fires that those people have been dealing with out there, California, it's not just California's program. There are 12 states plus the District of Columbia that also follow California's emissions program. So it's more like, I believe the number is closer to 120 or so million people that follow California's authority on this. So President Trump and the folks at EPA and DOT are really going after a big chunk of the American population.
Andrew, the Trump administration has offered up a very strange rationale for their move here to roll back fuel efficiency standards and greenhouse gas emission standards. And that is They're claiming that lowering these standards will save lives. They say that people who drive fuel-efficient cars drive more, therefore there'll be more accidents. They also talk about fuel efficiency standards causing automobiles and trucks to be more expensive, therefore people can't buy the newest model of cars and won't benefit from the standard improved safety apparatus in these cars. What do you make of this rationale?
Well, on its face, it's kind of hard to even believe. And we are still digging through all the documents to get to how they figured this out. But it is fairly clear that none of those arguments actually hold up in the real world. The idea that people are driving more and therefore getting into more accidents, I think, is kind of belied by DOT's own stats on highway deaths, which unfortunately have been up in whole numbers, but I believe as a percentage of the vehicle miles traveled are still relatively low. I think we can all attest that distracted driving seems to be a bigger cause of accidents these days than anything else. Making vehicles more expensive, even if the vehicle is increased a little bit in price, that is pretty much dwarfed by the savings on the increased fuel efficiency that you get. Estimates put it between, somewhere between $12 and $2,000, depending on the price of gas and the type of vehicle. But all vehicles are getting more efficient. So, you know, even folks that need to drive trucks for work or need the space for families versus folks driving smaller, even more fuel efficient vehicles. All classes of vehicles increase in their fuel efficiency, which really saves everyone money and really reduces emissions. So it's really kind of hard to buy into the argument.
Andrew, I wanted to ask you about effective challenges to what's underway now with the Trump administration by way of these fuel efficiency standards, greenhouse gas emission standards. What is being done to challenge what the Trump administration is doing here?
Sure. There will soon be an open public comment period, so we encourage everyone to take advantage of that. You can find that on regulations.gov and then also on the EPA and DOT websites. Anyone can comment, and that will be taken into account from the agencies when they do the final rule. There will also be three public hearings. And of course, there's going to be legal options that will go on with this. I believe it was 18 state attorneys general announced their intent to fight this rollback if this is what the final rule looks like. And you can expect a wide range of organizations like Sierra Club and many of our allies to also be involved in those lawsuits. But it's full-throated defense of these rules. The Trump administration really is going to have to make quite an argument to win this, we think. These rules are very popular in the public sphere, and they're also well-grounded in the law.
That was Andrew Linhart, Sierra Club Associate Director for Legislative and Administrative Advocacy. Learn more about groups opposing the Trump administration's rollback of auto fuel efficiency and pollution standards by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, and more than 60 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
August 8th, 40 years of resistance. It seems incredible, but it's been 40 years since the police assault on the Move House in West Philly. 40 years. 40 years since Rizzo's cops fired hundreds of rounds into a home in Powden Village trying to kill Move members. 40 years since Delbert Africa was kicked, rifle-butted, and slammed with a helmet by cops who only went on to be acquitted despite videotape evidence. 40 years ago, a beautiful baby boy was born to Debbie Africa in a Philadelphia County jail cell. For 3 precious days, mother and child shared each other's company before jail guards discovered the birth and the two were separated. That boy is now a man, Mike Africa Jr. And several weeks ago, he drove his mother home, and mother and son were reunited. As he looked at his mother the next day, he realized that this was the first time he'd ever seen his mother's feet in his 39 years of life. For 40 years, from August 8, 1978 to today, Move members have demonstrated, protested, petitioned, and spoken out against the unjust imprisonment of Move members. These protests continue until all of them are free. Move, still on the move after 40 years. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Not only because it occurred over a decade and a half ago, around 2003, but because it involves descendants of an ancient people, the indigenous people of the Americas. In the mountains, several hours west of Mexico City, lies the city called San Pedro Tilanixco, an indigenous town of Nahua people. For years, they engaged in light farming, the raising and bartering of magic mushrooms, and some clothing production. In 2000, big businesses entered the town and tried to own all the water. The community rebelled, staging blockades and protests. The moneyed class called in their armed enforcers, and before you knew it, violence struck San Pedro Tilanico, and about half a dozen people, 5 men and 1 woman, were accused of killing a local flower grower, Isaac Basso. According to eyewitnesses, Basso slipped and fell down a canyon, all by himself, but no matter. Members of the local water committee organized to resist the seizure and sale of water by Mexican agricultural businesses took the fall. Sentences of up to 50 years for defending water. They are Domingo Gonzalez Martinez, Lorenzo Sanchez Barrios Aval, Marco Antonio Perez Gonzalez, Pedro Sanchez Barrios Aval, Romulo Arias Mirales, and Teofilo Perez Gonzalez. Several others have been charged, but not captured. They are indigenous political prisoners of the liberal and neoliberal state of Mexico. Support them in their just struggle for the water that flows in the mountains.
from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Follow the Money evoked in me an odd mixture of feelings, fascination, indignation, awe, and rage. I learned a good deal from it and met people, amazing people, who I had never heard of. I've got to add another emotion, envy. Why? Because in Pennsylvania prisons, where some 51,000-plus souls reside, Dennis Bernstein's flashpoints are not heard. We're in Pennsylvania, 3,000 miles away. Also, there's no internet access in these joints, so the steering, soul-touching, and moving interviews with Dennis and his guests are lost to us. That is, until Follow the Money. Now that these remarkable interviews are available in print, the vast world of social, ecological, labor, gender, political, national insecurity, legal strategies are open to millions beyond Pacifica's frequencies. Here we see that Bernstein has one of the best jobs in the world. He talks to fascinating people from a wide and brilliant array of life. Most are engaged in some of the most challenging struggles of this era against entrenched state and corporate power. Here we see activists and participants in the battles against state and corporate snooping on the people, against the growing repression machine, especially versus black and brown bodies, against gender sexual expression, dangerous border wars, global assaults on the world's peoples and environments, the horrors of Palestinian existence under the heels of the Zionist apartheid occupation, and much, much more. Another feeling, anger. Why anger, you wonder? I've learned of people's struggles that have been largely ignored by the complacent corporate media. Here, there are hundreds of untold stories that could and should be told by the corporate media. To this date, most of these stories remain untouched and untold. This is an immense disservice to the American public, proving beyond cavil that the nation's media is primarily the purveyor of infotainment to dazzle, distract, and delude viewers, readers, and listeners, not to inform them. So, when you read these interviews and learn of these pivotal events in the life of the nation, how can you not get angry? How can you not feel that corporate news is little more than a basket of emptiness, of echoing fog? Bernstein's Flashpoints provides a powerful searchlight through that fog. It is common for people, especially young people, to pine for the good old days of the 60s. They often lament the lack of movements in the U.S. today. No one can read Follow the Money and come to such a conclusion ever again, for the nation is bursting with movements. For people are fighting with hope, imagination, and deep love against the forces of greed, exploitation, and expropriation by the minions of capitalism, racism, militarism, and unjust state power. Dennis Bernstein has brought some truly remarkable minds, voices, and hearts to his listening audiences at KTFK's Flashpoints. Now, these beautiful minds can speak to new audiences of readers, not only in prison, where, by the way, there are voracious readers, across the country, and indeed, worldwide. I found these interviews both enlightening and delightful. Thank you, Dennis. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Aretha, 1942, 2018. With one unmistakable name, a musical legend was born. Aretha. Born on March 25, 1942, in Memphis, Tennessee, raised in Detroit, daughter of the famous gospel preacher Reverend Cecil L. Franklin, she was born to a world made and moved by music. Her father taught her timing and phrasing, but the precocious Aretha learned young that her voice, with its incessant, pure, ascendant tone, could topple walls and open hearts. It took her to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987, and at least five of her many top hits have since become classics. Respect, I Never Loved a Man, Freeway of Love, Share Your Love with Me, and Something He Can Feel. In her matchless career, she had 20 number one hits, from Respect and I Never Loved a Man in 1967 to Freeway of Love, the summer 1985. Her fans, though, loved her like family, and it didn't really matter where she was on the charts. She sang with utter, moving, emphatic emotion and captured hearts near and far. Her voice, her gift, rang like a bell in the night. But she didn't only shine on stage. During a recent interview, she described herself as a domestic goddess. And what job is harder than raising black children in America? As black mother, she was indeed a goddess, reigning over the rhythms of life and love at home in Detroit. For a black woman to go from the Jim Crow South to become a queen of the kingdom of music, and then a goddess at home, is no small thing. She was, is, and shall ever be Aretha, who lightened and enriched the hearts of millions around the world. She returns to the celestial choir after 76 summers of earthly life. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
The following is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, originally airing April 13th, 2018. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour airs weekly on Winnipeg-based CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is also available for download at globalresearch.ca. This week, we mark the fourth anniversary of the death by suicide of an individual, investigative journalist, and independent media critic who served as a major inspiration for many in the post-9/11 period. His name was Michael Rupert. The son of a father and mother who were both deeply involved with America's intelligence agencies, Mike was given top secret clearance from a young age. He would attend UCLA and graduate with honors in political science in 1973. He would then pursue a career as a narcotics officer in the Los Angeles Police Department. He would be forced out in 1978 after blowing the whistle on CIA dealing of drugs within the United States. 18 years later, he would confront CIA Director John Deutsch at a public forum about these illegal covert activities. Director Deutsch's poor handling of the encounter reportedly resulted in his being passed over for a guaranteed position on President Clinton's cabinet. Toward the end of the 20th century and throughout the first decade of the 21st, Rupert's investigative reporting and analysis got distribution through a hard-hitting newsletter, which would become a website, FromTheWilderness.com. Eventually, From the Wilderness would begin touching on themes that would establish Mike Rupert's reputation as a dissident thinker and muckraking reporter. A former associate and longtime friend, Carolyn Baker, recalls that period in an interview we recorded and aired within days of Rupert's death. What are some of the maybe the standout moments for you that maybe helped embody what Mike was all about?
Well, just the incredible, impeccable research that he did. He was very picky about putting things out unless they were very well documented. And he certainly helped with understanding the Bush administration and that whole selection process that was not an election, but rather a selection. He helped all of us understand 9/11. You know, almost everybody who comments on their knowledge of Mike says he's the one who woke me up. So the man really served, did a tremendous service for people in terms of awareness, raising awareness, and being able to document what he was saying. And we have the greatest respect for that from the Wilderness.
Mike Rupert would become one of the more credible figures extolling the claim that the 9/11 attacks were deliberately facilitated by elements within the U.S. government, military, and intelligence apparatus in order to furnish a pretext for what would be called the War on Terrorism. He released a popular video, The Truth and Lies of 9/11, and in 2004 released the book, Crossing the Rubicon, Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil. One of Mike's close associates during that time was a New York-based academic, writer, and scholar by the name of Jamie Hecht. We reached out to Jamie, who is now a psychotherapist with a practice in Los Angeles. We first asked about how he first came in contact with Mike Rupert. Jamie mentioned his exposure to the September 11th attacks and his conviction that something was wrong with the official story.
I came across Mike Rupert's work on the internet. He seemed to me more grounded and logical and courageous than anyone else's. It was clear he was willing to contemplate nearly unthinkable hypotheses about who might be responsible and how this might have occurred. And I contacted him, and the way I did it was I saw that he was coming to speak in New York, in Harlem, and by that point, I was living in Harlem at the time. I said to him, I'm not really a journalist. I'm a poet. I write academic scholarship about literature and the humanities. But I was radicalized in my teenage years by listening to Daniel Sheehan and Helen Caldicott and people like that. And I believe in what you're doing. I've read some of your work, and I'd like to work with you. I'm no journalist, but I've published some articles on Counterpunch, which I had at that point. He said, I don't normally do this, but I'm going to give you a shot. I have a good feeling about you. A few weeks later, he contacted me, inviting me to write my first piece for FTW on a trial basis, he said, which was The Limited Hangouts of 9/11. He gave me that title, and I wrote the piece. And I wrote it with passion, and he liked the writing, he liked the thoughts, he liked the conclusions and the flow of the logic. And I wrote for him some more. Ultimately, he gave me the title of senior staff writer at FromTheWilderness.com. Later, he began calling me assistant managing editor as well, he being the managing editor. And I suppose that was a good fit. And as the 2004 campaign approached, Mike shifted into high gear with the book that he had long been meaning to write, mainly about 9/11, but also about the way things work in this phase of the history of the United States, Crossing the Rubicon. I remember the day that he and I, and I think two other staffers at From the Wilderness, tried to come up with the subtitle. Ken Levine was there, and I think someone else. And it took us about 10 minutes of rearranging the components of it until it gelled in my mind, and I went, okay, I've got it, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil. And we stuck with that, and that's how I met Mike.
Could you talk a little bit more about the personal side of Mike, both the benefits and the challenges of working with him at Front of the Wilderness and Crossing the Rubicon?
He did have a lot of psychological problems from a trauma background that was pretty severe. He had been through hell as a kid, and it really left its mark on him. But it did not, I think, impinge on the quality of his work. It was a broad sector of his mind that was especially keen and oriented to reality. Indeed, more so than most of us are, because functioning well in this culture, as in any culture, but perhaps particularly the culture of late capitalism and imperial decline, requires a degree of ongoing self-deception that Mike was deliberately outside of. I call it deliberate, but I have to add that that kind of happy illusion that allows us to participate fully in what this culture is and does had been stripped from him by, yeah, childhood trauma, as I've mentioned, but much more so by the adult trauma of believing in its institutions, being a Los Angeles police officer, and being the son of an intelligence family, indeed a CIA family. And here I'm thinking of his mother, not his father. And experiencing both of those authoritative institutions unmasked as authoritarian, perverse institutions whose goals are the opposite of those that they publicly espouse. That's a trauma. I'll just add that there's a particular book that I've read about the psychology of whistleblowers that I found bittersweet, compelling, and extremely insightful. It's by a psychoanalytic sociologist named C. Fred Alford, Whistleblowers, Broken Lives and Organizational Power. And I recommend it to everyone who has been touched by Mike's work and who's interested in why it's so difficult for people to come forward in an influential way about state crimes against democracy.
Jamie, did you have much involvement with Mike after the Venezuela period? I mean, and from the wilderness pretty much collapsed and went defunct. Do you have any recollections had you had much involvement with him after that period through the collapse movie, the radio show? What are your recollections from that period?
It was clear he was a changed man. The brush with death in Venezuela was not the first, but it was the most serious. At one point, with a capital T, if I remember correctly, did the old trick where they loosened the lug nuts on the right rear tire of his car somehow without his noticing, and he was about to get on the freeway and for some reason checked and discovered that sabotage had been done, and he was able to rectify it and drive away safely. Of course, at the beginning of his life as an investigative journalist, whistleblower, dissident, when he was still in LAPD, he was shot at, got a lot of death threats. But in Venezuela, it wasn't a question of whether or not the thing was going to happen. It had happened, and it was a question of whether or not it was going to kill him. And he went to Canada to recover. I don't know who took care of him, but they did a good job. And CollapseNet was his way of leaving 9/11 behind. He used to say, "We got trampled by an elephant, but it's behind us now. The opportunity has passed." And he looked at the even larger picture of industrial capitalism murdering the living planet, a thing that figures like Derek Jensen write and speak about so well. But he did identify with Native indigenous American spirituality, particularly, as is well known, that of the Lakota people. Critics call his engagement with it cultural appropriation. They're entitled to that view. I think it makes sense along certain lines. Others appreciate his discovery of the great gifts that culture bears. He was a great appreciator of it. And by some people, at any rate, in the Lakota community, he apparently was welcomed and given the name Tracker of Truth, which, as you can imagine, is a very good fit.
Jamie, I was wondering if maybe you have any concluding thoughts about the kind of legacy that Mike will leave behind.
Well, my belief is that he is the person who figured out how 9/11 was pulled off by the perpetrators. Others assumed, reasonably, that there was a stand-down order. But the people who wanted to do their jobs on 9/11 were many, and some of them were at the FAA, and some of them were in the Air Force, at NORAD, and the Northeast Air Defense Sector. They would not have obeyed a stand-down order. Some of them would have disobeyed it. Mike knew that. He knew that that couldn't be right because it didn't explain the thing. And he looked for another explanation, and I knew him and was with him while he was puzzled at the beginning and then step by step figured it out. I was in the room with him when he was on speakerphone with Barbara Honegger, the author of the most important book about October Surprise, and that's its title, which through the 1980 election to Ronald Reagan. Barbara Honegger is the resident Air Force Base historian at Andrews Air Force Base. And Mike had a conversation with her regarding 9/11 aviation, the scrambling of fighter aircraft, which I was privileged to hear because I was there. Mike figured out that it was through the scheduling of a number, I used to know all these numbers, I don't remember any of them now, of simultaneous war game exercises right during the week of September the 9th, a time when several domestic and foreign intelligence agencies had warned the executive branch of the United States that there would be attacks using civilian aircraft as weapons to fly into a list of American buildings symbolic of American life, including the eventual targets. It was a list of 10, I believe. And the people who had those warnings included Dick Cheney. And the person who changed the rules about who can schedule war games was Dick Cheney. And the person who scheduled the war games in spite of the warnings was Dick Cheney. And the person who, as Peter Dale Scott has written, had his hands on parallel equipment underneath the White House in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, equipment parallel to that at the FAA and NORAD, was Dick Cheney. And the person who insisted that he and George Bush testify only in secret, unrecorded, and not under oath was Dick Cheney. So Mike Rupert wrote a book called Crossing the Rubicon that was a case, as he called it, of means, motive, and opportunity for the crime of 9/11 against Dick Cheney, hoping that it would throw the 2004 election. It did not. But his legacy was that if you paid enough attention, did enough legwork, and stayed in touch with the ethical drive driven by empathy for the victims, you could figure out how a state crime against democracy worked, and you could get the word out. Because not all of our First Amendment rights have been taken away just yet. You can still publish a dissident book. You can't get it reviewed in the mainstream press, because it wasn't, but it was the best-selling book on 9/11 for several years, with the exception of the Cain Report. And though no major news outlet reviewed the book, they didn't attack it either, because they didn't want to draw attention to it. And as Mike pointed out, he was never sued for libel by the people he accused, because they knew it was true, and they didn't want it coming out in court. And that, I think, is not all of Mike's legacy, but that's the heart of it.
For a Canadian perspective, we caught up with Barry Silverthorne. He's based in the Greater Toronto area. In addition to producing the acclaimed Peak Oil documentary, End of Suburbia, in which there was a cameo featuring Mike Rupert, Barry had been a video editor and technician working behind the scenes on a special roundtable for the Vision Television Network, the first major broadcast featuring Mike Rupert talking about 9/11 and the first talk of his that I had ever seen. We got Barry to open up about what he remembers of Mike from that broadcast.
In the roundtable, I was really quite shocked at how easily he was able to take on Ron Adkey, who was one of the other guests, who was one of the people overseeing thesis. And Ron got a lot of facts wrong in the discussion, and Mike was right on top of him, so it was fun to watch.
Yeah, the CSIS is Canada's CIA, you might say, and they're defenders of the official story.
Yeah. Yes, and he, you know, he one fact that he got wrong, he actually was quite surprised to find out that there were still bombing raids going on in Iraq between the first war and the second.
I'm wondering if you might like to comment on Mike as a person, you know, what really stands out for you that maybe might come as a bit of a surprise for some of our listeners.
It's not probably a surprise, but I found that his research was so meticulous and so well done and so well backed up. And, you know, even when he did get things wrong, he was always kind of the first one to point that out and to, you know, to make apologies and make good on it. I always admired him for that. As I got to know Mike, I found that he was a very complex individual. For example, when we wanted to interview him, and, you know, it was very hard for him to find the time, you know, at the time I thought, we're willing to travel all the way to California and give you a venue. And he said to me later, this was months later when we met at a screening of The End of Suburbia, he said, well, you know, the other people that I've talked to sent me a limousine to pick me up, you know, and I was never sure if he was joking or, you know, whether he was serious that we didn't treat him well enough.
Well, Mike had gone to Venezuela for a period. This is around 2006, and he'd gotten quite sick. He had to come, he had to leave, and his first stop was in Canada, and you looked after him during that time. And I wonder if you might like to share anything about what that experience was like.
Well, at the time, Mike seemed to me, it seemed he didn't feel that he wanted to come back to the United States. He had already left the United States, and I didn't think that he felt particularly comfortable coming back. I remember meeting him at the airport, and he looked very thin and very tired. And the first thing he wanted to do was have a plate of ribs because he had nothing but, you know, Venezuelan food for months. And he just wanted to get back to being, I guess, back in his old world again.
Yeah, so that's, I'm sure he was very grateful for your assistance and cooperation.
Well, we went... We went shopping for, you know, we went to the thrift stores for used clothes, and we made sure that he got some medical care. I took him out to visit some horses because he really enjoyed the horses. I put him to work chopping wood in the backyard, and, you know, he spent a lot of time sitting in front of the fireplace reading some books and just resting up. While Mike was staying with me, we had a conversation one day. We were sitting out on the deck with our feet kind of dangling off the deck over the garden, and I told him this story about, I don't know where I'd read it, but something about when a bear attacks your campsite, you don't need to outrun the bear. You just have to be faster than the slowest camper. And Mike really liked that analogy. And it was interesting. For years after that, I heard him using that analogy all the time, and it always made me kind of smile thinking about that, you know, day when we sat there and talked about that.
Yeah, that is one of his more popular sayings, I think. So that's great.
And I'd love to know where it came from. If anybody knows, I'd love to know the source of it because it's brilliant.
Now, I think you eventually conducted him back down to the United States. So I don't know if you had much involvement with him beyond that point.
No, he had to get some documents back to his lawyer in New York City. And we put them in a courier and sent them off. And if I had not seen this for myself, I would never have believed it. But it was virtually impossible to get this package to his lawyer in New York. It got moved to the wrong facility. He tried to track it, and it ended up in Maine or someplace. It's like you couldn't, the only way you could get this package that lost was through actually trying to do it. I mean, it couldn't happen by accident. So after a few days of trying to get these documents to New York City, Mike was, I guess, strong enough, felt comfortable enough to go back. So one evening after dinner, we got in the car and drove overnight and arrived in New York City in the morning. I dropped him off at Jenna Orkin's apartment and had a quick nap, and then I jumped in the car and headed back home after. Mm. On a personal note, when Mike left my house to go to New York City, he left some Venezuelan bolivars, some coins, in the dresser. And I still keep them there in a little box on the dresser as a memory of his visit and who he was and his story. And I think that was a nice little thing that he left behind and probably didn't cost him much.
Jenna Orkin, just mentioned by Barry Silverthorne, would host Mike Rupert for the next 14 months. Someone who had researched government and EPA impropriety around the environmental hazards associated with the attacks and affecting numerous first responders, Jenna had first encountered Mike Rupert during the 2004 citizen hearings on 9/11, where she was impressed by Mike's keen and discriminating analysis, and especially his research into the war games, which forced an effective stand down of aircraft intercept procedures. She saw Mike both at his very best and comforted him during his darkest moments. In the months following his death, she composed the account Scout, a memoir of investigative journalist Michael C. Rupert, with Against the Dying of the Light. What do you think was the key to his appeal in the eyes of so many who followed his work?
He was able to connect the dots like nobody else, and he was able to present it in a way that wasn't too highfalutin. It made sense. It made glorious sense and was somewhat revelatory. And also, he had enormous charisma that worked in his favor.
He seemed to achieve a level of notoriety around 9/11, after 9/11, as you pointed out. And then something seemed to go wrong. There was that incident where the computers and his equipment and his office was smashed, I think it was around 2006, and that's seemed to lead to his departure from the U.S. to Venezuela. Well, you were close to him. What do you believe drove him to some of the actions that he ended up taking, and apparently to his detriment?
With respect to the destruction of the computers, that was during the time when he and Stan Goff were investigating the death by friendly fire of Pat Tillman in Afghanistan. And that investigation was then picked up by the mainstream media across the board and across the country, leading to the resignations or firings of a number, I forget the number now, so I won't venture, but Donald Rumsfeld left his position after that, and a number of others did as well. So Mike understood from the smashing of the computers that this is a warning, next time it'll be you. And he ran away to Venezuela, believing he would be given political asylum. And he just kept waiting and waiting and was told to keep a low profile. He would stand out as an American. So he had to stick around the hotel, and he got extremely depressed. And he was calling me every day, suicidal. And for the extent that I knew him in New York when he stayed with me for 14 months, he was suicidal every day, all day, for let's say the first 7 months. And the only thing that got him out of it was receiving notification that he would get his inheritance, that his stepmother had died. And I used that argument to keep him alive. It was like Scheherazade. Every time I left the house to go to work, I would say, okay, you're not going to kill yourself in the next 6 hours, right? And he would agree. And because he felt, you know, as a cop, he was a man of his word, he wouldn't kill himself in the next 6 hours. It was very much an AA, one day at a time approach. So thank God he didn't kill himself on my watch. But he was looking out the window and muttering to himself, I know when and I know how. And, you know, ominous things like that. It never left his mind. So if you were to ask what would he be doing if he were alive, I would answer he would be killing himself again. He would have done it, if not that day in April, 4 years ago? He would have done it the next day or the one after that.
As somebody who knew Mike very well, I was wondering if there's anything you would like to address in terms of the way he's being remembered by admirers and detractors alike.
The thing I'd like to correct the record about the most is what peak oil means, because many of his detractors use that to malign him and everybody else in that movement. Peak oil never alleged that we're reaching the end of oil. It said we're reaching the end of easy oil, and that has been proven correct because the methods that they're using now to extract oil, despite the drop in price, economic price, the price environmentally has been enormous, and that's patently obvious from the BP disaster to, you know, gas and oil, well, and chemicals in people's drinking water and all of that. So that's not going to stop the detractors, but that's thank you for the opportunity to set the record straight there.
What are your understandings of you know, what made him tick? Could you maybe just give us some insights in that regard?
All right. Let me preface this by saying that I speak as a New Yorker, and if you know, if you've been here, you know that it's fairly common for us to go to shrinks, therapists, and I've spent a certain amount of time doing that and also reading about it, so I'm not a professional and don't pretend to be, but I'm certainly very interested in it, and so I will give you my 2 cents worth there. Mike's father left him and his mother when Mike was, eight. And the father would go off on these long business trips and then come back and go off again and come back. And Mike felt very abandoned and obviously, as children do, he felt that if he'd been a better son or, you know, pleased his father in some way, Daddy wouldn't have left. Especially as Mike, for whatever reason, had very little respect for his mother. She drove him nuts. And when he lived with me, I reminded him of his mother, and I drove him nuts. He did not have respect for women, particularly women his own age. If they were much younger, then that was a little different. So he had this dichotomy, adoring the father figure, despising the mother figure. And he would talk about Jungian archetypes, and what I finally understood was that he was really talking about Hollywood stereotypes. And again, I think this worked both to his advantage and his detriment. So the archetype of the hero kept him going, but then when it failed to work, when he did not become the hero who turned around the ship of state, being the entire world, from its path of destruction, when those efforts failed, I think that's when the other side of him rose up, the suicidal side, which he considered his feminine side, because his mother was very depressed and she was on antidepressants. And when he was staying with me, the doctors were prescribing antidepressants and he was sleeping all the time as his mother used to. And so he loathed that image of himself, the feminine, the passive, the incapacitated. And so that view of the world where it's you're either on the top or you're on the bottom, I think that also destroyed him.
How would you sum up his legacy, maybe his crowning achievement, if you were?
Yeah, the crowning achievements were many, and they were very weighty. The website, which is now fromthewilderness.net, the main book, Crossing the Rubicon, the movie Collapse is well worth watching. And once you've seen those, decide where you want to go from there. And the other legacy that Mike left, which is very valuable, is in his disciples or colleagues. Well, they were first disciples and then colleagues. Rice Farmer is one. Mark Rabinowitz at oilempire.us, who has been a guest of yours, was a very esteemed colleague, and his websites are worth viewing. Nick Levis is worth watching and reading as well, Rice Farmer's website. So we all owe Mike an enormous debt for giving us the insights that he did.
You're listening to a special broadcast of the Global Research News Hour airing on Winnipeg-based radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is available for download on the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we are taking a special look at the life and legacy of investigative journalist Michael C. Rupert on the occasion of the fourth anniversary of his death, determined to be a suicide. In your book, Crossing the Rubicon, in the introduction, I'm just going to read a quote from it. I had studied how the investigation into the murder of President John F. Kennedy had been controlled. I had also personally painful and verifiable knowledge that the murder of John's brother Robert was a CIA operation. All the goodwill and energy of the researcher activists in each of these cases was deliberately and meticulously sabotaged by interested parties and their allies in the dominant political class. Mike, is it possible for you to just sort of help, you know, spell out that the nature of that sabotage, the pattern that you saw with the Kennedy brothers and what we've seen today with 9/11?
We're also seeing it with Fukushima.
Mm.
And we're also seeing it with climate collapse. This is the same machine that has always been there and available, and had available to it enormous amounts of resources, a tsunami of resources to throw at a disinformation campaign to muddy the waters and confuse people's perception, the purpose of which was to overwhelm, drown out in noise the people who were carrying the real message. For example, me. We have seen the rise of clear and extremely well-documented disinformation artists from Alex Jones to many others who have enormous amounts of money and resources to muddy and confuse the waters. If you go back to the 60s and the 70s, the government program called COINTELPRO, which was directed ruthlessly at the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement. It is has been abundantly documented. War Churchill, who I've met, did a great book on it. That the government, if you will, these are people who will be doing what they do. Don't pin it on one agency. It is a paradigm within every agency, but they will send infiltrators into campaigns to sow disinformation, to create discord and harmony, to sabotage operations, to muddy the message, to insert poison pills specifically. Peter Dale Scott was a mentor for many years, and he had a great line. Disinformation, in order to be effective, must be 90% accurate. People will eat a little tab of poison if it's wrapped in a beautiful, sweet, sticky cinnamon bun. But that poison will kill them nonetheless. And that has been the chief tactic used for many years. That's why I have so separated and isolated, put in quarantine, if you will, my own life's body of work so that it would not be contaminated by the enormous amounts of disinformation that have been sown not only into 9/11 and JFK and Bobby and Martin and everything else. That's the way it continues to work. Now,
Mark Rabinowitz, who was mentioned by our last guest, is a frequent guest on this program. He publishes the site oilempire.us, a political map to connect the dots. His site has an in memoriam section dedicated to Mike Rupert, among two others, and a lot of material which presents Rupert's investigative work in a very reverential light. He joined us from Eugene, Oregon.
Well, I first came across Mike Rupert's work immediately after September 11, when I was trying to find alternative opinions about what had just happened, because my immediate reaction that morning was to suspect some sort of covert operation. I heard him in person shortly after that at an event in Portland, Oregon. It was was a presentation that became a video, The Truth and Lies of 9/11. And it was extremely impressive. If you go back and watch it almost 17 years later now, it still holds the test of time. I heard him in person a couple more times. He came through Eugene. I went to hear him in San Francisco. And we were on a discussion list that talked about these topics. Ended up writing a couple of articles for his newsletter, From the Wilderness. Even contributed a couple of points to his book, Crossing the Rubicon.
Could you comment on how your own research and analysis was influenced by Mike's work?
Well, I've found Rupert's connecting of the dots extremely powerful. And one of the first times I heard him speak, he was talking about how, since our society had chosen to avoid connecting dots, like the Kennedy assassination and other crimes of state, it enabled the perpetrators to keep doing more and more of these things. I've been aware of these types of concerns since the 1980s, both in terms of nuclear war plans, ecological problems, energy problems, the dangers of nuclear power, and many other things. Rupert had a very nice way of piecing these concerns together, which I found extremely powerful. Unfortunately, he was very disappointed that his work got read quietly in high places. The Intelligence Committees of Congress were subscribers to his magazine, but he didn't get the kudos and respect that he was hoping for, and took it very personally in many ways. And he was disappointed in particular that Crossing the Rubicon did not result in Cheney and Bush being denied a second term, since the documentation of suppressed warnings and overlapping war games with 9/11 in any rational world would have resulted in prosecutions rather than re-election.
So I think that for people who have followed Mike and been admirers of Mike and, you know, who get clued into this whole idea of deep politics and deep state actions, it's hard to rule out the possibility that maybe this is a suicide that was, or a murder by the CIA or whoever, that's made to look like a suicide. I was wondering, can we responsibly rule out that possibility, given everything that's out there? Everything
that I can understand why people might have a intuition that is a more accurate description of what happened, but Rupert did write about feeling suicidal. I heard him in person say this a few years before he did die. So I have not the slightest doubt that he did kill himself. But I suspect one of the reasons was the profound disappointment that the world was going to hell in a handbasket and it didn't seem like things were shifting in a good way. So in a way, you could say that he fired the trigger, but it was the bigger social situation of the world that provided some of the rationale. I'm not justifying that. And I think one of the legacies of Mike Rupert is not just that he did world-class research for a number of years, but that if you're going to deal with deep politics and deep ecology, you need to have some deep inner strength and deep interconnections with those around you. And it's a complicated balance of being able to see the evil in the world and the good in the world and staying sane and stable as things unravel. I can't overstate the importance of that.
Talking about people who go into this difficult realm, there's another figure named John Judge who, by interesting coincidence, had also died. It wasn't a suicide as far as we could tell. It was so much as a more of a natural cause. John Judge, maybe you might want to just give us a bit of a lowdown about what
his work and maybe how that relates in some sense, that those dynamics may relate to Rupert.
Well, John was a similar deep politics researcher from a somewhat different path. They were roughly the same age. John died 2 days apart from Mike, and he died of complications from a stroke. He had been in ill health for a number of years. But his spirit was awesome, and he focused primarily on the assassinations of the 1960s. John also focused on 9/11 research. He lived in Washington, D.C. He spent most of his life there. His mom was even a whistleblower at the Pentagon. So like Rupert, he grew up in the shadow of the national insecurity state. But John also had the nerve to point out that some of the 9/11 claims were false, most notably the claim that there was a faked plane crash at the Pentagon that day. And he had the nerve not to compromise on pointing that out, despite the fact that there were 9/11 truthers who weren't able to admit that they had been misled in the search for truth. And when you deal with these types of big topics, it's important to have skepticism not just of the official story, but skepticism of so-called alternatives to the official story, because sometimes they're not correct. Fake news is ubiquitous, and sometimes it masquerades as conspiracies exposing the truth. And John stuck to his facts, and it's a great loss that he is no longer with us as well.
I was just wondering if you, before we close, if there's maybe a certain memory of an encounter with Mike, either in person or through some sort of correspondence, you might want to share with our listeners.
It was a privilege to get to spend some personal time with him at a number of these events and to see his humorous side shine and to have some great discussions with him while he was preparing Crossing the Rubicon, which, despite everything, is still probably the very best book on what happened on 9/11. It's incomplete, but I strongly recommend it, as is Truth and Lies of 9/11 film, which I believe is still on YouTube. But both him and John had incredible spirits in the face of collective denial, and their passing is partly a suggestion to the rest of us that we need to be more socially conscious about meeting people's needs for gently and respectfully talking about the deepest issues. And in a way, maybe we need to think about how to transform the psychology of this. And I'm a big fan of the truth and reconciliation paradigm for these sorts of crimes of state. And maybe if there was more social and collective interest in these approaches, then pioneers like Mike Rupert would feel more supportive.
Maybe, first of all, we should just allude to a certain metaphor that you brought forward. Basically, we're facing a crisis situation, and you made reference to the Titanic. Faced with a sinking ship, there are three groups of people you're likely to run into. The people who are in the deer in the headlights, freaking out, they don't know what to do. There are those who are busy making the lifeboats, and then there are those who want to go to the bar and get a stiff drink because the boat is unsinkable.
Yes.
It occurs to me that there's probably a fourth group. Maybe you could call them traditional activists, people who are trying to lobby the skipper to slow down and change course, or working with the crew to try to fix the boat, or maybe some of them are in the bar handing out DVD copies of The Iceberg Conspiracy or something like that.
Very good.
There are people who get peak oil, but then they don't get peak oil. So maybe you could just go through some of the critical facts that people really need to know to really get their minds around the dimensions of this problem.
Well, first let's define the Titanic. And the Titanic is human industrial civilization. That's what's sinking. That is what cannot be prevented or stopped. And that's because of the fact of peak oil. basically, very simply, peak oil is a point in the, all oil production follows a bell curve. It's the point where you reach the top of the bell curve. And after which, no matter how much money, energy, technology, wishful thinking, animal sacrifice, whatever you want to throw at it, nothing is going to increase the amount of oil that is produced.
In the final years of his life, Michael Rupert would develop a connection with native spirituality and assimilate Lakota ceremonies and perspectives into his own worldview. He began to develop this connection in Crestone, Colorado, a small community in the Sangre de Cristo mountain range. He'd stated publicly that he had gone to this spot to die. However, he would eventually return to California, where he would continue with his weekly Sunday night internet radio program, The Lifeboat Hour. It was through this program that Mike connected with Portland, Oregon-based Mimi Gurman. Mike had admired her work on anti-nuclear issues and on the literal fallout from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, one of the issues about which he was most passionate toward the end of his life. They became close friends. She was the last guest Mike had on his show before his life came to an end that evening. The Global Research News Hour got in touch with Mimi to get her share some memories and thoughts about the departure of Mike from this mortal plane.
We had lots of truth talks, Mike and I, and he had me on for that in the beginning, and then it kind of expanded from there. We just got to know each other, and he wanted to talk more, and I wanted to talk to him. And so in the process, we established a very close friendship off radio.
Did you ever think you'd find you form such a close spiritual bond with a former cop?
I like to look at Mike as a whistleblower and somebody who found truth. And so I don't look at Mike as a former cop. I look at him as somebody who found truth, and he went to meet that truth and be with that truth and walk in that truth. And that's the person that I met. He shifted our sensibilities, especially those who needed sensibility shifting to occur. He was able to do that, and that was his truth. That was the etheric piece of Mike. There's Mike the person, and then there's all of the energy that Mike held, and it's all of that stuff that is the shifter, the shapeshifter. And he was able to help so many people locate the truth of what we're doing here and what is happening here.
Well, you were one of the last people to speak to Mike. Your last conversation was on the Lifeboat Hour, I believe, and his very last program. Could you maybe talk about, you know, your reflections on that conversation and the subsequent news that he had died apparently by his own hand?
Well, I've been talking to Mike a lot that week, and on Thursday I called him. I knew about not his plans to die. I knew about his other plans, what was going on in that week, and he said to me that he was having Carolyn Baker, and he said, you know what, I'd like you to come on the show too. And I said, oh, I don't need to come on the show. Carolyn's an incredible speaker and has so much to offer and say. And he said, for sure. He said, but I really want you and Carolyn on together. And he was really adamant about it because I was feeling that I wanted Carolyn to have all the space. You know, it was a show. We didn't know Mike was going to die. And he started to sound that Thursday and Friday a little bit frenetic. His energy was changing, and I felt it. And I asked him what was wrong. And you know, we had personal discussions about some things that like I said, are personal. But I could tell his energy was changing. Something was happening, and there was great importance in this moment, in the now, in this show happening as it was about to to happen. And so I just went with it. And then, of course, as we know, he killed himself right after the show. So for him, what I do know, and some of the things he shared with me, as far as having two women who he I think I can say this, who he cherished and respected. He had reverence for women and our place and in from the beginning of time and our knowledge and our closeness to the earth. And I think for him that that was another piece of Mike's spirituality, and that was one of himself that he wanted to end his show with two women.
If he were around today, what do you think he'd be talking about on his show? What do you think he would be focusing on? What would he be saying about, if anything, about all of the developments that have been going on in the last few years?
I think he did already talk about all of this. That's the thing. To be ahead of your time means that you've already spoken about the future. And, of course, there really is no future. There's just today. So Mike has spoken about this. He spoke about this about division. He's spoken about politics. He's spoken about oil and oil as money. He's already, he saw all of this. Any which way you look at it, it's been happening. Still happening, and it's going to continue to happen until we're no longer here. And that is what's happening. And he knew this already. I was going to say, if anything, he would no longer feel the need to talk about it. And look what happened. Mike no longer felt the need to talk about it.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about how you personally have gained and what the world has gained for Mike's presence on this planet?
I noticed this after Mike died. I should say after Mike left his body, because I really don't feel that Mike died. Sometimes people need to wrap that in a form of terribleness, in a form of anger, in a form of, you know, making sense of something. And the only way to do that is to put your own junk on it, you know. I see no junk around Mike. Mike was a shining star who I didn't have an opportunity to know long enough here on this planet, but who I know is with me, and I know is with everybody if you allow that knowledge to exist in you, and that we all do not just meet up later, but we never leave each other. And so I miss him less now because of that, because I'm more in tune with that level of my reality, of that reality, that we don't leave the energies that we meld with, you know, that we get to stay with those. And when we leave the body, we're still with that because energy doesn't die. And so, yeah, you know, I'm grateful for having met him. I'm grateful for the star alignment, for lining us up, for him to call me and get in touch with me. And, to be able to enjoy him in the time frame of, you know, Earth that I was able to, and to see how many people received his truth. I mean, for me, that was beautiful, to see how many people he affected, he shifted. Wow, I mean, good for him, you know. If we could all do that, we'd really be making change down here. But unfortunately, we're all still pretty wrapped up in the fact that we think this is kind of two-dimensional here. You know, we got a body and we do these things and we live in our chains. Mike wasn't like that.
Before we close this program, we wanted to hear from one more voice. Mike Rupert had fallen in love with a special woman named Jessie Ray, and she with him. A special note was left for her explaining his departure from this world and her life. She declined an on-the-record interview with the Global Research News Hour, but expressed support for this endeavor and wishes to include the following statement. Mike was my friend. I think of him every day. Mike wanted to be of service to this world, and he did it the only way he knew how, with fearless passion and unbending dedication. I can think of nothing more attractive than that. He was a light in the dark to so many people, and he taught us to be vigilant. He changed the course of my life, and I'm forever grateful for the time we spent together and all I've learned from him, both in life and in death. This program is dedicated to Jessie Ray and to Mike's beloved dog, Rags. We've reached the end of this special edition of the Global Research News Hour, airing on Winnipeg radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is available for download at globalresearch.ca. We've heard excerpts from previous interviews with Mike Rupert from the CKUW programs Here There Be Dragons and Global Research News Hour. You can reach us with your feedback at globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Music this week was provided by David Bearwald. We'll end the show with one of his most popular songs. Thank you for joining us. My name is Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
Soon you'll forget me, I'll fade from your memory, and that's how it should be. You won't need me now. The world will embrace you, and lovers will chase you, their kisses will take you where I could never go.